Australian Survivor.
Survivor New Zealand.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
20 federal.
£1 million.
Million euro.
Million
shekels. 1 million rubli.
Tribe spoke.
Scheibe trocken.
Ship.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Australian Survivor. I'm your host, Shannon Gus, here at the end of a bleak week for Australian Survivor. We lost our own Nick Iadanza. We lost Lockie, who became the Bachelor. Actually, that wasn't bleak. That was actually the most amazing thing ever. We're definitely going to talk about it. And then we lost Dirty Harry, and it's not looking good for some other faves. Honestly, like, where to from here? So I have such a good guest to cheer me up, to cheer you up, because a lot of people seem upset about this, and basically just to make life better, I hope. So please welcome in someone who is one of my absolute favorite people to talk about anything with, let alone Survivor, but my co-host of Survivor South Africa, and someone who is just basically doing so much in the Survivor and pop culture world, the great Mike Bloom. Mike, thank you, genuinely thank you so much for being here.
Listen, Shannon, I'm happy to be here, as you said, to talk about literally anything under the sun. You have set up lofty goals for me to apparently cheer up the entire Survivor community. I'm going to try to meet it. I think if it helps, we can help form some sort of, I don't know, shelter for all of these poor, poor booted pre-merge contestants on Australian Survivor, raise them like an aviary, like Zach rehabilitating hundreds of birds, so we can get them flying again on a future season.
Yeah, are you saying that we needed some sort of, like, edge of extinction? Because, no, it never gets that far. But if any season kind of needed it, this lopsided season where some of my favorites and, like, literal friends just went out. I'm not going to give Edge of Extinction an edge at all. But it's a sad week. You know, just so the listeners know, I was stressed out about this week for a long time with, like, work. And I'm going on a cruise with 23 members of my family tomorrow. So I, like, knew that I needed someone that I wouldn't have to stress about the podcast and could just enjoy it. So I booked you ages ago, and you are here making the ultimate sacrifice, missing the live showing of Winners at War, which we so appreciate.
I don't know. Well, considering what happened last week on Winners of War, we really have been like sitting Shiva with some of our Survivor favorites this past week, right? We're sort of capping off a season that started with the boot of Ethan Zahn, culminating in the boot of your friend and mine, Nick Iadanza.
Yeah, that was a rough few days. Honestly, yeah, I mean, with Winners of War, you're going to lose favorites every time. The problem with Australian Survivor is there's a lot of people I could lose, and I'd be happy, but it's just not happening at the moment and may not happen for a while. So that's my concern, but yeah, it's been tough. I mean, yeah, you're here to help out. I really do appreciate that. Missing Winners of War is a big deal, but I need the cheering up, because the Nick thing was hard. I mean, let's talk about that. Let's kind of start with that as the headline. Losing Nick, for me, for you, I assume, was one of the harder boots I've seen.
Yeah, let me clarify here, okay? I was not pointing and laughing at the screen when Nick got voted out, okay? I do not appreciate being painted as a sociopath, apparently, in the Survivor community. You point and laugh at somebody once at a live show, Shannon, and suddenly you are branded that for life. Dirty Harry showed us you can work against your reputation. I hope to rehabilitate myself as well. But no, it was devastating. Though, I guess the first thing I'll ask you is, you know, when you lose a player as a Survivor fan, that you're going to lose them, would you rather have them go out in a way where there wasn't anything else that they could do, or in a sliding doors way, if something had happened or if they had done something, they could have survived that boat?
In terms of the way Nick went out, I could not be happier. Like, well, no, I mean, I'm devastated. But in terms of the way that it happened, that would be exactly what I would want to happen. Like, I really believe there was nothing he could do. To have the gift of David being like, we're going to blindside him. This is what a blindside means. And then to get Nick's confessional being like, something's wrong. That's not right. And for him to not go with the plan and to be one of the only people we've seen try to actually make some sort of move happen against Dave, even if he didn't have the numbers, I was so happy that he was given that, to show that in a terrible situation, he still had the right read, a way better read than what Dave seemed to have, because Dave seemed to think he was blindsiding Nick, which he wasn't. So
yeah,
for me,
he needs to read the Survivor Dictionary in terms of reading.
Yeah, but no, but yeah, there was a lot of book stuff, a lot of poetry stuff, but Nick's voting confessional was right and Dave's was wrong. They weren't blindsiding Nick. So as a fan and a friend, I was so happy to get that. I think that's my issue with your question, and that's why it's something that has been difficult for me to answer, is that for the first time, I don't feel like I watched this as a fan. Like, I feel like I watched it as a friend of Nick's, and like, I'm not pointing and laughing at the screen. Like, you do that and you should go to the bad place for that. Like, that's really bad. But when you watch
one time,
you did it. It was terrible. But when you watch your favorites go, there is a sense of theater about it. It's a TV show. Like, this is an analogy you won't get, Mike. But like, as a football fan, I've watched my team win grand finals. I've watched my team lose a grand final. And there's beauty in that agony. And I wouldn't trade that experience the same way I wouldn't trade the wins, because it's as much a part of the fandom experience. It's as much a part of what makes up that passion for that thing that you love, whether it's sport or Survivor or whatever it is. And it's exhilarating. You look back at those moments, even me looking back at when Malcolm went out in Game Changers, while I had the appropriate reaction and was devastated, I watched that in a fan group with 120 fans in Sydney. I still remember that night of like the collective pain. And that was fun. Like, I look back now, I'm admitting maybe that I'm as bad as you, but I look back at those things, and even if it's terrible, and even if my favorite's getting screwed, and even if it's Saree, even if I know them to a degree like I did Luke last season, there still is that fun agony. The fun agony of being a fan, as much as it shows when you have success, you know, your favorites have success. But for Nick, it wasn't fun at all. I'm never going to look back at that moment like, ooh, that was a good, you know, like, I really got my money's worth out of being a fan out of that. Like, I just felt really sad and deflated, and have for the days since. And that, I guess, speaks to my personal experience as being his friend. And I know a lot in the community know him and feel like they know him from the podcast. So I'm not sure if that really translates, but it was, for me, my saddest moment watching the show ever, like, in terms of the vote outs. Wow. And very different to anything else I've experienced as a fan.
Well, first, let me say that the feeling of your team losing the grand final is really universal, in my opinion. I'm sure we've all had that type of experience personally in our various footy experiences.
Just imagine Saree getting screwed. That's what it's like.
Well, so to your point, and I've said this a bunch, that in my opinion, we're going to be talking, spoiler alert, a lot about Survivor storytelling. This podcast, both, you know, it's highs and its lows. But in my opinion, Survivor storytelling is at its best when it makes you feel something. And yes, that feeling might be sad. You know, there's seven dwarves. Not all of them are happy. And I think that, to your point, getting to explore that emotional side of the spectrum means you have a genuine investment in characters and a genuine investment in the outcome. And of course, I was devastated to lose Nick, not only due to the fact that, like, hey, it was one vote before the merge when things could have really opened up. Hey, there happened to be an advantage in the game that could have saved Nick, at least for this episode, though we'll talk about whether or not it was a good decision to end up not using that advantage. You know, it's one of those things where, like, if you just make it an inch further, there's a beautiful, pristine meadow where you can graze all you want to, but you're tethered to this stake within this junkyard. And that's as far as you can go. And unfortunately, that's what happened with Nick. I mean, I guess, you know, it makes it a little bit worse due to the fact that when we saw everything with Phoebe happen twice, it really did seem like we knew this was not going to end well. You know, that essentially was a story of, like, Nick's going to get stabbed at some point. It's just a matter of how much blood he loses, whether or not he's going to end up dying or able to barely make it to the hospital that is the merge. Shannon, I guess on that grim note, we should also probably come clean here, give some exclusive intel to the fact that, yes, there was heavy emotional investment from the whole RHAP community in Nick's well-doing here on Australian Survivor. But I don't think anybody knows that there's some extra special investment in his performance in All Stars from you and I.
I don't feel like I did a lot. I think you were helpful to him. Like, I don't know how helpful I was, but
okay. So I'll try not to beat around the bush here. I'll try to become clean. So about, I'd say, like, a snatch of days, maybe like 4 or 5 days before Nick ended up going out for All Stars, he reached out to Shannon and I and essentially enlisted our services in helping him, you know, bone backup on Survivor in preparation for All Stars. So for that like brief glimpse of half a week, Shannon and I were the Rob and Sandra on the Island of the Idols, trying to educate Nick best we can as to how to approach a second time out.
Strategic consultants is what I call it. I mean, I think that everything I told Nick, he achieved. You know, like I said to him, like, be super social, make friends, remember that these are people who are going to be in your life long term, hopefully. And like, you know, instead of being like, drop and give me 10 push-ups, it'd be like, drop and tell me 10 things you like about Lydia. You really got to go out and like these people and have them like you back. And that's what I really enjoyed seeing from the show. Like seeing him say to Henry, we got to slow it down. I told him not to like lie for no reason and all of that stuff. So to get on the X interviews and have people like Abby and Lydia say how much they liked him, I was like, he really fulfilled all of the things that I asked of him. And that's great.
Yeah, I guess on my end of things for my curriculum. So I guess one of the things I saw play out, and this is a little bit admittedly of like us patting ourselves on the back, but considering this is the first time that Shannon and I have ever, I guess, advised a Survivor player, like this is pretty damn cool. It was pretty damn cool to watch this happen. but I know when I talked to him, I'm like, listen, you're probably going to be on a tribe with Lee, knowing Australian Survivor. You find him, and the first thing you do is like sit down. Yeah. And so, and we saw it heard in your exit interview, right? They're like, day one, he sat down with Lee, and we're like, okay, water under the bridge. And like, look how that arc ended. You know, it ends with Nick in his final words saying, like, I hope Lee goes all the way. That is crazy. Like, you cannot bet on it whatsoever or convince anybody after the finale of season one that Nick would not only be working with Lee but actively rooting for him in the game by the time he left his second season. That's a crazy arc, and we'll put a pin in that because that's, you know, one of the storylines that I think has been a bit brushed under the rug in lieu of larger storylines. I guess the larger thing that I ended up instructing him in that I guess played out more matter-of-factly over the course of the season was Nick was obviously, as you talked about before, compiling this volume of puzzles. And the one he happened to inquire me about was, hey, you know, what do you know about that cube puzzle? You know, you take the puzzle pieces and you put them together in a cube. That's the one that famously Rob Cesternino's tribe lost out in Survivor All-Stars when he got voted out of the game. And I, you know, did some research, showed him some videos, and to the point where I actually sent him a couple of like toy versions of it from a company to have him practice on it. And my mind, Shannon, was blown when an episode, you know, 3 weeks down the line, he ends up in a pretty desperate situation and single-handedly wins a challenge for his new tribe using that exact same puzzle. It was like freaking Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, you were way more helpful than I was. I was just like, make friends. I was like sending, like a mom, like sending her kid off to school. I was like, I just hope the other kids aren't mean to you. Like that was all that I cared about. You had actual practical advice that played out, which is, you know, you were the, I don't know who was better of Rob and Sandra. You were the better one. But I honestly I think that what could Nick have done more to make us proud? Like he was just in such a bad spot. And I genuinely think like when I look at it, it's not just like, okay, you know, it's devastating when you're a fan and you watch or whatever, but like also sometimes it's more annoying than devastating when it does feel like that person's just like in a really bad spot or screwed or something like that. And for that to happen to Nick as well, like for the fact that like not everyone gets swap screwed and there are things that you can do, but like if you just look at the swap, almost every person who got out was basically just in a bad position from the swap and these groups kind of stayed together. And that might make strategic sense, but you know, Abby, Lydia, and John were all in a bad spot, and Matt Rogers, and Phoebe, and Nick, and I'm like, kind of shocked they didn't switch it up again. People tweeted me, they're like, do you think that production is helping out their favorites get far? It's like, definitely not, because when Matt Rogers played his idol and was in the worst spot and is like the biggest character of the season besides Dave, they not only could have swapped to save him, like, they probably should have swapped for more interesting television, and they hid the idol at the cake reward at Makuta, which I think is blatantly unfair, and then I don't think Vakama had its own idol. So, like, the two things that could have saved Matt Rogers, the biggest person, and would have been more fair, and would have been better TV, they didn't do. So, I'm just, like, right, I have a few questions about production from this pre-merge and from the first 5 weeks that I'm just,
a
like...
A few?
Yeah, where I'm just, like, ugh, why? Why would you swap? Like, why would you put two idols on one side? Now Vakama are completely screwed. against David Tuaros. They never even had a chance if they, you know, at all. Ugh, I have so many rants about this.
Yeah, well, not to mention the fact that, oh, don't worry, we'll supplement it for Vakama by providing this thing linked to a yellow piece of yarn that's only good for the next two tribal councils and, like, extremely situational.
And it's just super confusing. We'll talk about the advantage, but confusing.
Oh, we'll talk about it. Well, to your point, I'm very surprised that, like, after John got voted out, JLP wasn't like, okay, we're going to have a surprise mutiny. We'll go in alphabetical order on Vakama, starting with M. Matt, do you want to mutiny over to Bakuda? You know, like, this idea of just shaking it up. Because I will say, now that we officially have the pre-merge in the rearview mirror, I think I can say with confidence that I think, while this season started off on such a strong note, and there are still really good things about this season, and we'll certainly get into it, I do still think there are exciting things in this post-merge situation, but I think the swap really kneecapped this season for a good chunk of time, considering that, like you said, it's not like entertaining stuff didn't go on, but if you look at the votes from a systematic perspective, it seemed like people were playing, you know, the safe route, but the strategic route, and we saw this during Survivor Ghost Island, where a lot of times there's a direct correlation between the best move and the least entertaining move. There were a few times when those blips sort of go off the radar, but I think this is a great example of, like, yeah, you have a coalition, stick to it and keep pushing forward. And it's interesting, you know, I you would think that with a big season like All Stars, production would really want to throw people on their toes. And I guess we got that a bit with, like, the twists, the row of twists we got with the exile twist and then the swap and then the double tribal council into the fire making. But I'm a little surprised that they let off the gas then, especially since, like you said, that only really prompted the vote offs to just become that much more straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the tribes at the swap, they swapped, you know, 7 episodes after the swap. Besides Flick, I think those are just the people who were on the bottom of those tribes. Like, if you did, after the table setting vote of those tribes, or just knowing the dynamics, like, those were the people that you would assume would go home, which isn't super interesting, and was also just really frustrating, because it feels like, again, people can debate swap screwed, but it does feel like these people were in bad positions. Like, if you just change it up again and make it more fluid, then they have to work harder to, you know, use their skills to do better. So, yeah, people benefited from it, people lose out from it, but I just think there are other things that could have been done. And, like, can I have a rant that's, like, tangential to this? Because...
Oh, yeah, I'm ceding the floor to you. Rant away, sister.
The cast. Let's talk about the cast. Like, because... preseason, I was like, it's pretty good. Like, 2/3 of the cast is good.
And totally agree.
Now I've realized that that's not good enough for an All-Star season. For All-Stars, the key is consistency. If you look at US All-Stars, if you look at Game Changers, if you look at this, the cast is inconsistent. And it's so almost like irritatingly predictable what will happen. Because if it's just a third of the cast, that's not that good. They're actually, like, their power is elevated to being, like, 2/3 of the cast. Because, like, obviously a lot of them are going to do well. They're playing an easier game. They're not as big threats. And it makes so much sense, too much sense, an annoying amount of sense, for all, like, the GOAT characters to get together, as they should, for someone really talented like a Dave to wrangle the GOATs and go with them. Like, it makes sense that they're in such a good position right now. Add in some, like, out of, you know, relationships outside the game, which obviously complicates it. And it's just, like, kind of a messy way to look at it. Because It's not surprising to me. It's not surprising to me that if we look at the 7 that are in power right now, it's questionable casting. And it's not just bad luck, because we've now seen it several times with inconsistent casts where the people that are lower down in terms of casting are going to do better unless they get kind of screwed like a John did. Why would you get rid of Tarzan? Why are you targeting Mo Hope? Like, Jackie, Zach, all of these players have an easy run, especially if they team up, which they often do. It's not a coincidence that the final 3 of Game Changers was, like, Sarah Lucina, Troy Zan, and Brad Culpepper. It's not a coincidence that Amber won All-Stars when she was the last person into the cast. It just makes sense. So I would almost work rather like a mediocre cast that's consistent for an All-Stars, because it's just frustrating to watch people who are just, like, there's so much casting variance, and often the people who are a lot better casting, obviously someone like a Dave or whatever will break through and do well, but, like, people who are better casting just have a harder run at it a lot of the time, and it's frustrating to watch the Mo Hopes of the world and their band of minions go on past the people we've all been excited to watch, and maybe that's some of my bias showing, but, like, I just feel like it was inevitable and frustrating, and the next time I see an All-Star cast that's only 2/3 good, like, that's not going to be good enough for me, and this season has made me realize that.
It's tough because I still go back to the thing that I wish in retrospect. And look, again, we got a lot of good out of this season, so I'm not going to say let's erase the entire thing and start all over. But I really do wonder if we got rid of Shane and Jericho and threw in two other people and we labeled this Australian Survivor Second Chances, like what that would do to everything. You know, maybe they felt like this is Second Chances would not play as well when you play for the umpteen time as a soundbite. But to your point, this pre-merge, in my opinion, has really been all about reputation. It's been all about, like, I mean, from the get-go, when Henry's going after Harry, being like, we know it's Dirty Harry. You know, the reason why a lot of these people are being targeted is because they know what they can do from their previous times out. So by that corollary, the people who really didn't do that much in their first times out or don't have much less of a body of work to show for it than others, say, for example, when you're a Tarzan who lasted 4 episodes or you're a Moana who lasted 6 episodes, like Moana did a lot of interesting things in season 3, but she lasted a significantly shorter amount of time than somebody like Matt. And so Matt's going to be the one getting more of that attention than Moana, even when they're in an alliance together. So, I mean, we always wondered going into this if this was going to be, to your point, more like a Survivor All-Stars or more like a Heroes versus Villains. And I guess maybe what this is proving is that seasons like Heroes versus Villains, and I guess we'll see this in Winners at War, might be more of the exception rather than the rule.
Well, they just have consistent cast. Like, it makes sense. Casting should not dictate the strategy, which I often, when it's inconsistent, it obviously will, because it makes sense that like is then like a driving force, because it's something that's so clear that it then is going to work into your strategy. Whereas like if the whole cast is consistent, even with something like a Second Chance, where it was like a pretty even cast, all one time losers. I want to talk about Shane and Jericho, but yeah, like all one time losers, like there was like pretty much consistent quality across the board. Then it doesn't affect the strategy as much, and people just kind of make their own on-island dynamics. Whereas, like, clearly it's plain to see that a Zach is very, very, very disparate from a Phoebe. Like, Shane and Jericho actually aren't my problem at all, because I think the jump from, like, a Sean to a Shane is not that big. From a Dave to a Jericho, not that big to me. They all kind of stand in that tier. My problem is some of these people to merge, to ask Jackie back, I mean, nothing against her, but to have Jackie back, who, maybe they saw something we didn't hugely see, but I don't even think she's delivered on what I've seen from her in season 2. And yeah, to not ask Sarah and Tara and Christy, like, it's not even the people saying no. Like, those are 3 people they could have asked, where it's kind of crazy to me that they didn't. So that's my issue.
Yeah, and I think that it also maybe speaks to why they were cast. Like, I'm pretty sure Tarzan is living up to why they cast him. You know,
and
like, same thing
problem.
With John.
That's it. That's yeah, it. That's the problem. What did they expect of Tarzan? Is it this? Who's voting out Tarzan? Ever? When? Why? Why did he need to come back? He lasted 4 episodes. He had the perfect 4-episode arc. He chose wood. Jericho chose cookies. He immediately got voted out. Jericho used the cookies to win. And he was the hero and the martyr. And it's like, that's a beautiful 4-episode arc. There's no part 2 to that story. What did we expect to get from Tarzan? Is he the one who's going to shake the game up? Like, he hasn't come out and surprised me in any way. And I've watched this show now for, like, I don't know, like 1,000 hours. There's not even a person who's come out and I'm like, wow, I didn't expect a lot of you, but you've surprised me. Like, I feel like everyone is exactly who I thought they would be preseason. And that is a problem, because they should have been better than that.
First off, do not balk at Tarzan's big move coming soon to 10 God. Marketing in the next couple of weeks. We should look forward to that. I would push back a little bit on your last statement, if only because, you know, there's Boston Rob and All-Stars, there's Parvati in Micronesia. There is almost always that person in a returning season that you're like, you can even argue maybe Sarah in Game Changers.
That's exactly my point. There hasn't been that person.
See, I would disagree. I would say Moana is that person.
If Moana is that person, that's a problem. She's not Boston Rob.
She's sort of running the tribe like one right now, to
be
honest.
I'm sorry. Boston Rob is, like, Boston Rob has as much charisma as Pinky Finger. You know, anyway.
She's doing well strategically,
and she was always quite a good strategist. But, like, in terms of charisma, is Mo Hope the Parvati, the one who goes from Cook Islands being just, like, the flirt to being one of the best characters of all time? I don't think any of these people have, like, in the genius, we might say, like, the Kyung Hoon effect. Who is the person who's come out and been like, wow, they were so much better than I thought they would be? We're so lucky we had a second season with this person. Because we didn't get to see it last time. I don't, like, if Mohope is that person, I agree she's the most, but I don't think that that's a good thing, because I don't think it's been that much.
Well, then, to your point, I feel like, obviously, there has been a lot to come under fire with Australian Survivor and its storytelling slash editing, especially this season. And I gotta say, there are probably many, many factors as to why the storytelling has gone in the direction that they did. And I think casting's a part of it.
Yes.
You know, I think that it's not that people like Jackie and Tarzan and hell, Lee and Zach are not people who can't produce sentences for television. I just think when you're a producer and you might be looking at like, okay, well, we have Dave repeating for the umpteenth time how he's going to bite into someone's jugular, chew it and spit it back in their face. Or we have Tarzan sort of talking about his morning routine. This is much, the former's much more appealing to me. And so, listen, I have a lot to blame on the editors, and we will certainly get into it. But you can feel from a certain capacity the fact that they might be a little more hard-pressed to find bigger characters to highlight than maybe in previous seasons at this stage of the game.
I agree, and that's on casting. Like, there were other people that could have been there. Like, someone like Lee, I've really enjoyed his arc, his evolution. It has been a bit in the background. But you got to have Lee, like, you know, that he was like an icon of the first season. There just are a few people where I just have question marks, and knowing who they didn't ask. Yes, some people said no, and that's tough. You know, like the Benji effect. Imagine if Benji is there over Zach, or, you know, I guess that would be the one for one.
That literally is the replacement. Yeah.
So Dave has picked up Zach as his, you know, as his number two, and that's brilliant gameplay. And I don't trust Zach to turn against Dave in the way that if he picked up Benji, Benji's turning this game on his head. Like, that's why it's hard to look down the barrel of the rest of the season. And it's like, okay, so say Dave and Zach actually were with Bakuma in a different, completely unrealistic world. Say that's the seven that have just pogonged, like a Sean and a Mo. Then you're feeling okay about it because you're thinking, firstly, that group's just way more likable and interesting. If they do pogong the other group like Asaya did to Lamina in Panama, you'd be like, bye. But also, because Vakama are like good players. Well, they're interesting players. You would never expect the seven Vakamas plus Dave and Zach in that iteration of what I'm talking about to go down to the seven, because Harry or AK or Sean, any of them is going to pick up some numbers at a point and cause chaos. But this seven, Dave is a crazy person. Maybe Dave. Sean is a slippery player as well. Maybe Sean. But Mo, she's a good player, but she kind of has her numbers. Who's making the move? Is Tarzan? Is Jackie? Is Zach? Is Lee? This is four people of that majority. So that feels very deadlocked to me. And it's not a hugely likable majority. And so that's frustrating. I mean, we're talking about the begonging and everything. It has only been two votes that make sense that emerge. Obviously, you vote them out and don't immediately flip. Like, I get it. But I think the reason people are so despondent is because just with this group, you can kind of see it continuing for a long way. And hope does seem lost in that regard.
Yeah, but Mo Hope definitely doesn't seem lost. She seems in a prime position.
Yeah.
I mean, I do feel like there are openings, and we'll certainly get into it. But yeah, it's tough to see that those who are in power are probably the most rigid of those left. I mean, it does give a bit hope to those on the bottom of like, yes, it's Shawnee, AK, and Brooke who are ultimately on the bottom. But if there are three people that could wiggle their way out of a situation, it would be Shawnee, AK, or Brooke.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're rooting for the bottom, I'd much rather have them than like a Jackie or a Tarzan.
Jackie, well, I would rather my favorites had power.
I mean, yes, of course, as an unbiased fan. But yeah, and, you know, again, I guess it's an unfortunate externality of the fact that maybe they just feel like Jackie and Tarzan aren't providing comical content except for their Fijian I Love Lucy where she farts in their bed. Jackie has just been someone that's just been a giant question mark for me, because I did enjoy her in season two. I did not balk too much at her casting because I feel like she was someone who, again, especially if we were adapting to a Second Chances theme, like, she was pretty damn screwed by Henry leaving her high and dry, especially with that idol, you know, so that when Jericho and Luke were finally able to make their move on her, they were able to do so behind her closest allies back. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. Maybe it's due to the fact that we haven't seen a lot from her, but she's coming across a little smug to me. And then we're hearing all these things being told at us about like, wow, Jackie's a wild card. Jackie's blowing in the wind. I'm not seeing it at all. maybe they're setting up that she and Sharn and Mo are going to try to flip something. But really, I mean, she has the least amount of confessionals at this point. And she really has become like the purple person, which I guess that means lock her in for seventh place, considering Australian Survivor's records with that. But I feel like I can understand where everyone stands in the game, at least from a strategic perspective, not necessarily a storytelling perspective, except her. I have no idea what she's thinking out there outside of the cooking segments and the Tarzan segments.
Yeah, Jackie actually would have been the one preseason that I would have been like, of all the people I didn't really get to see a lot of, maybe she'll have the Kyung-hoon effect. Like, maybe she'll be really interesting because I didn't think...
Right, well, because...
Yeah.
Remember, back in season two, she was the one to really stage the first big coup on a saga. She was the one to be like, I don't care if Sam and Mark are winning all the challenges for us. We're going to get rid of them. And that was a really fun storyline to watch. That's what made season two, one of the many things that made season two so fun. I thought she was going to bring that in here, but I guess for one reason or another, you know what? Maybe it really was like the line in the sand that was drawn in Vakama. Maybe because she felt that she was so forced in a corner with Matt's alliance that it hasn't allowed her to play as, I don't know, deviously as she was able to do previously.
Yeah. I mean, from a narrative perspective, I think it's been a letdown from season two, which obviously has made it much further, but as a character has definitely not popped as much. You know, from an edit perspective, I think Dave has more confessionals than 6 of the 10 players combined.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think AK, Lee, Sean, Jackie, Tarzan, and Zach combine it for just a couple of confessionals under where David is. So that only leaves like Shawnee and Brooke and Mo, who aren't in that group, on the group that have as many confessionals as David. And it is like, it is on the editors because that's never okay. And I do think there are really good confessionalists who aren't getting as much time. Like AK would be one of them. But again,
totally.
Maybe they don't have as much to work with casting as well. So it's a hard one. I feel like mistakes have been made. And going back to it, I just have questions. Like to hear that Sarah wasn't asked, you're like, I don't care what happened. Like, you know, whatever happened with Benji, like, they should have done whatever Benji wanted to get Benji on the season. If Benji is part of that majority, there's no way that this group is just going down the line because he's going to shake it up. Like, in terms of the movers and the shakers and, like, the followers and the sheep and whatever, like, the balance is off, unfortunately, for an all-star season. I was talking to my brother about it, and this is a hot take, so I'll attribute it to him. But he said, season 2's cast is better than the all-star cast. And that's crazy because it's an all-star cast. It's meant to be like the best of the best. You shouldn't have a newbie cast that's better than this cast.
Well, I think season two, and look, I love me some season two. Season two, and this is a bit of a hot take on my part, is my favorite Australian Survivor season, bar none.
That's not a hot take. Like, everyone thinks that.
No, I think there are a lot of people that prefer season 4, but that's a discussion really? For another day. We'll do our own little season ranking maybe after this season. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why is not necessarily the mix, but I guess the way that things transpired.
Yeah, because Tarzan went in episode 4 and it was a gift and then they brought him back.
Right. But I mean, like, yeah. And the thing is, even in the end game, you had, you know, people like Ziggy, for example, who, you know, were not necessarily the most mind forward players, but they were mixed in amongst all of these big players. And I think just the way that the cards fell, and part of that, as you said, is due to reputation. A lot of those players fell out and they keep falling out. And again, it's smart strategy from the viewpoint of some of these people in the 7 who feel like they can, you know, keep in lockstep with these people and they know they're going to be in with them. I guess taking this all the way back to Nick, because I have a couple thoughts as to, you know, I guess where all this went wrong. I mean, I don't think it's not necessarily a fulcrum point, but Shannon, I've been really thinking as to, like, you know, tracking Nick's trajectory, because of course I paid extra attention to it. This was our Survivor son. What exactly, you know, was the start of the
metaphor?
Downfall? I don't even
where
know.
Where his parents, Robin, Sandra, what else are we?
I don't know. It's like that when they did the composite photo of all 20 winners together. That's sort of like Nick for you and I suppose, and maybe a little bit of Rob and Steven in there too, for good measure. But I really do think a very formative moment in Nick getting his torch snuffed was, I guess, not something he did, but it really goes back to that double exile vote, in my opinion. And I really do think that Sharn balking on the plan at that last minute ended up being a big domino that ended up coming down to Nick getting his torch snuffed here in episode 13.
Yeah, Sean is the weak spot of a lot of Knicks game. I still think he was in a bad spot. Like, he wouldn't have had the numbers with Sean anyway, or maybe at a point. Yeah, you know what? Yeah, if Sean had been more loyal to him, nah, he still would have been a bit screwed. But at the first, I don't know. No, it was a bad spot, but Sean was the worst ally to him ever. Like, he said in his ex interview, it was like, he thought he was working with Sean, but when you come down to it, when was she, like, putting him first? I think it was a blind spot for him, how close she was with Mo and how that would win out over their in-game relationship. So if I look back at that, like, yeah, I think that is an issue.
Yeah, because I think what would happen is, even if the exact same swap happens, I mean, first, you know, if the XL vote goes the way that Nick wants to, maybe, you know, Shawnee doesn't get voted out of Makuta. And so maybe she's not forced to join Vakama. And so that doesn't bring her away from him. Secondly, even if the swap goes the exact same way, you know, Moana is super close with Sharn, as you talked about. And Sharn would be somebody in Nick's corner who could personally vouch for him to Moana, maybe over somebody like David, for example. So maybe when it came to this pivotal moment of like, okay, do we get rid of Nick or do we get rid of Zach? Sharn could be like, I think Nick, we can trust Nick. You know, I got Nick, you know, dead to rights. I don't trust Zach. Let's get rid of him. So I do think that Sharn ended up being a very important relationship to Nick's longevity. Maybe Lee was the more emotional relationship, but Sharn could have been the one to really help him out. And just for one reason or another, she wasn't able to include him in her plans ultimately.
Well, the reason was that she was aligned with Mo, who was aligned with every other person on the tribe. I mean, if you look at that vote when Nick went home, you know, she's got Sharn and Lee. She's got Dave now, who has Zach, and then she's got her three. Like, they just all kind of fell into this alliance. So, yeah, it's frustrating. Like, if you look at, you know, the rants, I feel like this is the opposite of my Windows at War coverage, where I come on for half an hour to just, like, rant about how amazing it is.
Oh, and I don't want to be the yang to this yin.
I don't want to be super negative, I say, an hour into this negative podcast. It's been a bleak week. It's always darkest before the dawn. We will rally and Vakama will win. But, you know, just looking at it, it's like, if they don't do the, you know, the weird exile swap when they do it, and then they just like actually swap, so that, because that twist had no meaning, and then just do exile at another time and send those people to another tribe, that's like another quasi swap which changes the dynamics. Like, there are just like little decisions they could have made that would fix a lot of bad decisions like at once. So yeah, but you know, you can't blame it on everything. Someone like Dave could have been swap screwed, and he had it on lock. Dave's playing like an unbelievable game. So I'm not saying all of these people were swap screwed. I'm just saying that if you're producers and you're looking at all of these people go down the line and just getting picked off in a 7-episode swap that is pretty rigid, change it up. Like, it's obvious anyway.
Yeah. Well, let me also just say that, like, I do not begrudge Makuta at all for getting rid of Nick.
No.
Because I mean, I think that he showed, even in his final episode, that he had an impeccable read on people. And not only that, he was willing to call out those reads to people's faces. We saw that all the way back from when Henry had that fake idol that he played through the tribal council, and Nick just being like, that's not real. Or, you know, even in the double tribal or the Phoebe tribal council, when David pulls out the idol and Nick says he's not going to play it. You know, like, he was able to call those things out in the moment, which is super scary when he's not on your side. So it makes sense. The other thing, and I'm so glad that Dave vocalized this in the merge episode, the first thing of many that we heard him say was, I got rid of all the connections to old Vakama from this tribe. And that's when, like, the light bulb turned on for me of like, great, that makes so much sense. Now he's the only lifeline. And as we saw, he played the swing perfectly. He was that Trojan horse, and like Ajax, he slew all those Trojans and, you know, took Fair Helen back. And then there's the whole Odyssey thing, but we won't talk about that. I think that, you know, he really positioned himself perfectly, as he said, for the merge. And then that just makes me wish that it was not needed to be surrounded in all of this narrative emotional reasoning. You know, like, I feel like the community has unfortunately soured a bit on David and his portrayal. What a difference a week makes, or a couple of weeks. And I feel like part of that is because it makes a better story for him to be like, I'm voting Phoebe out because she didn't vote with me against Nick. And less so, I'm voting out Phoebe because she has a connection to those old allies and I don't want her hopping back at the merge. I want to be the only access that they have in terms of information. You know, the latter makes much more strategic sense. but the former is going to make for that big narrative hashtag revenge moment that you know the producers want.
I always thought that he should have voted out Phoebe, and then Nick makes sense too. Like, I gave him 3 shizzy points last week. It made sense completely, but even if it's not just the connections, which is another brilliant point, but it's also like, I've spoken now at length about the group that he's with and why that makes sense to the point where it's like literally inevitable in any type of season like this. It's the obvious strategic thing to do to go with that group where if he was with Vakuma, they're definitely coming for him at a point. And if now with Makuta, I just like the options are more limited for who's going to come for him. Like, it makes so much strategic sense. I do think that, yeah. So for Dave, there's 3 things. There's like the strategy, there's the TV part. And is there the third thing? Is there that personal thing at all? I still don't know. I don't think with, like, obviously with Harry, there's not. That's all strategy. That makes sense. And then he's got the TV thing of being like, I'll have the most consecutive days, which is so arbitrary.
Oh my God. We need to talk about that because, I mean, this is when you really start to see the strings of like, I mean, I really feel like Dave's playing the part of a producer here. And maybe that calls back to Boston Rob. You know, him and Sandra effectively played the role of producers from a game mechanic perspective out in Island of the Idols. But this idea of like, what's going to make the best TV? Like, I know Pia was even talking about that with you last week with first time players. I cannot imagine how much it increases with people who are returning. But he's like, all right, I need a reason, I need a rationale behind it. Let me grow into True Dork times mentally for a second. Ah, yes, the most consecutive days played in back-to-back seasons. Yes, that's the metric that I want to go for. That's the one I want to put on a plaque and put in my Survivor rumpus room. It's so random, because first off, if we're going Samantha semantics here, I feel like he used the completely wrong vernacular here. He used the wrong terminology. I think if he said, you know, the most consecutive days played in back-to-back seasons, I guess that's a better case, but I'd still give him a big old asterisk because, I mean, he got voted out 2 weeks before the end of season 4. So, like, yes, they were quote-unquote consecutive, but he did take 2 weeks off of Survivor, essentially, then another 6 weeks and came back. You know, this is not Harry, who is still like basically feels like he's walking on agony by the time he comes back into his second season in Survivor All-Stars. Secondly, if we're going with his original terminology, he's playing with 2 runners up, one who played for a full 55 days and looked on the verge of death. Hell no, you're setting no records, man. Just get out of here with your record book. I don't care about that. Harry's clearly dangerous. We don't need a reason behind it. Otherwise, you're like a petty Betty. And this might be outside of Christina Correa spilling octopus or Stephanie Favor saying she wanted to get some gravy and mashed potatoes in Survivor Cook Islands. This might be the pettiest reasoning I've ever heard of to vote somebody out.
Well, like, I don't see this as personal. Like, I see the stuff with Phoebe. I still think that was personal. People will agree to disagree on that. But, like, this is TV and, I guess, strategy. Like, why does he think this will be something that will be necessary to his final tribal council? Like, if Dave makes it to the end, it'll be hella impressive. He has, like, 1,000,000 resume points if he makes it to the end. Like, imagine what that game would be. He has 2 idols. Like, that's why you would vote for him. Is anyone on the jury going to be like, I wasn't going to vote for you, Dave, but you have the most back-to-back consecutive days ever. And yeah,
I've been looking at the confessional charts, and we definitely heard from you more, so I guess edgically I'm gonna have to give you my vote.
Okay, I could actually, like, I could vote on that. Some of these all-stars might vote for you, not vote for you, because you got more confessionals.
Yeah, forget bitter jurors, we have edgic jurors going on now.
I don't have any problem with what Dave is doing strategically. People have some problems with, I guess, the personal stuff with Phoebe, and then a lot of people have problems with the TV stuff because I think it's becoming a bit of overkill. But, like, strategically, the reason to get rid of Nick is, I'm actually laughing thinking about it. When Nick was in their tribal council, and, like, I think it was Mo was like, I really want to move forward with the 7, which is true for all of the other 7. And Nick's like, me too, this is my group. Nick would be on Vakuma so fast, it would be like, you would just see, like, an air bubble in his body like a cartoon, and that's how fast he's, like, run to the other tribe. I actually laughed out loud when I don't know how he said it with a straight face. He was like, you are my people. Not AK, not Harry, not Johnny, not Brooke, yeah, who was
look,
at my
I know
wedding.
I know you just voted out my closest ally. And yes, I did vote against you, one of you, 3 times in a row. And I've been in the minority ever since we've swapped. But I feel really good about us, guys. I really feel like I bleed green right now.
Honestly, good on you for even trying to say that. It made complete sense to go for Nick. I think the only confusing thing about Nick, and the only question that we have is Harry's decision. And so we have to talk about it rather than just like airing our grievances. Okay. So obviously Harry, like I've had actually a lot of questions about this of you can agree or disagree, but some people don't seem to understand at all why Harry would not give the advantage when it was only good for that tribal council. So it, just to kind of explain it for anyone who still doesn't understand or hasn't had it explained to me by me on Twitter or on Talking Tribal last night. We've never seen this advantage before. There's no way they got clarification from production what was going to happen. So it came down to trying to predict what production was going to do. Would triggering an on-elimination episode mean that they would just merge straight at 13, which unfortunately I think we have found out just via the community that that is what would have happened, unfortunately. But would that happen? In which case, definitely, I think Harry has even said on Reddit, of course he would save Nick. Of course they want Nick. Of course they want that connection, that number, that possibility of new numbers. Or would it delay the merge? Would it mean that they have to merge? This is, I think, something we even spoke about last week. Do they have to merge at 12 people like they have for the last three seasons? Mm-hmm. In that case, does Nick use the advantage and then they go back to a challenge, Makuta lose, Nick goes home, or Vakuma lose, and Harry, whether he's wrong or right, seems to think he would have been in enormous trouble. He obviously tried to use the advantage last time. He's obviously cagey with telling his allies about what it is, which makes it even more seem that he still thinks he's in extreme trouble. So he might think that he's not, you know, assuring himself the merge if he does that. So where do you fall on this decision from Harry?
Okay, wait. So it's been confirmed that production couldn't clarify to them
production
what
didn't
happens
clarify
after
to them.
They...
Believe me, if they clarify for them, Nick is in this merge.
Okay.
I hate that, by
that
the
is
way.
That is straight up bullshit. Yeah. Like, I'm going to straight, like, that is straight up bullshit. As a production company, you can't have contestants be like, okay, thanks for giving me this advantage. What happens if I use it? And then they go, I don't know. And, like, well, twiddle their little cheeks. Like, you can't do that.
It defined the entire game. And that is sad to me. Like, I hate when there's, I'm so negative in this podcast. I hate when there's things that contestants can't plan for. I want them to have the information so that the best players can rise to the top and use their skills with that information or make mistakes with that information. I hate that a lot of the season may have been dependent on Harry just not knowing, because we've never seen this advantage before, and it wouldn't happen if we'd seen the advantage before and knew how it worked, and it wouldn't happen next time because now we know. But a lot of the season is dependent on the fact that Harry didn't know what would happen in this advantage, and I don't think that's good TV. And I think it just takes one line on the parchment being like, you can use this advantage anytime before day 29 and then the tribes will merge. That's it. And then he knows that they're definitely merging, and then he's making a decision based on what he wants to do, not trying to work out, because this is an argument I've been having with my brother all week. He's like, it was obvious that they were going to merge at 13. They wouldn't put the merge in the players' hands. They wouldn't say, okay, like they want to merge on a Tuesday. They're not going to let Harry decide that they're merging on a Wednesday. That's like the landmark episode of the season. The challenges, they have to change challenges. Although I will say that they often do team individual challenges, which just, they literally just have to change the rules of like, the last one standing wins for their team, or the last one standing wins individual immunity. So I don't think there's
or were you? It's not exactly like this is, I think, maybe only the second time ever that they had an individual challenge to start the merge. Like, they could very easily, I know they did an auction a couple of weeks ago, but like, put in another auction to start the merge. You know, you could put in an extra seat there, but
think it was obvious. My brother, my cousin have all said to me it was obvious they're never going to delay the merge, they're never going to put that in the players' hands. I think that's easier to say when your whole game doesn't depend on it, and you're Harry, who's been at the bottom for a lot of the swap, who thinks he's in trouble, who might be in trouble, who has the merge at like a save point of his game, who's basically clawing his way to get there, and who thinks and doesn't know that if he uses this advantage, he's pushing that line out for himself and maybe even not getting to a point where he has a chance at the merge at all.
Yeah, I think that he was guaranteeing his own safety, which, if the name of the game is self-preservation, I do not behoove him whatsoever for doing it. I actually had assumed up to this point that you made this revelation that, you know, it apparently was going to be an early merge. I always thought it was going to be another round.
Yeah.
Like, I imagine that Australian Survivor, they love the gotchas, right? They love the big, oh, you thought it was one thing, but now it's another thing. And so I could imagine that, like, they would have loved to do the non-elimination episode and then be like, oh, we're not merging. We're doing this again. Maybe they saw the writing on the wall and knew that would have led to a bad outcome, as you outlined, if that is the case, and Nick does use his advantage. If Makuta loses, Nick just basically goes home again. As much as he tried to talk to you about like trying to make this gambit with a fake idol and showing Lee and Sharon that are on the bottom, I think we've seen how rigid that seven sum was, that, you know, Nick was really a dead man walking in that regard. And over on over on Vakama, Harry is looking at three people who have been together since the beginning. As much as AK might want to be a swing vote between these two pairs, you'd have to imagine he's siding with the king and queen in Vakama over him and Shawnee. So it really was a calculated risk. I just really, really wish, now knowing that information, that he had known about it, because for a number of reasons, that would have made things so much more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, let me clarify. I still think that Harry should have given the advantage to Nick. I really wish he did, from a fan perspective. And I think he should have, because he's Dirty Harry. He's a big move player. You're down in numbers. Nick is a crucial ally. He brings information, which is the biggest thing. Make the big move if you're that down in numbers. I agree. Like he made the conservative move, which he said on Reddit is like basically his biggest regret, or his only regret of the times he played, because it's not Dirty Harry style. You know, after a troubling swap and a long pre-merge, he got himself to that safe point, and he probably thought, I will work my magic from there. I was on the bottom last time I got to emerge, and I made it all the way to the final three. I will find a way. And I'm sure he did think that. He probably thought there were cracks in Makuta. The last time he saw them at Tribal Council, it was a 4-3-2. They probably thought that they had Dave more than they did, because obviously they had worked with him before. Obviously Harry had worked with Zach before, a little bit before the swap as well. So he probably thought he had options and was like, just get me there and I will try and do something with it. And I totally see that point. And while I do often say that, okay, that's the wrong read, which is like the whole game, so there's no excuse for a wrong read, I actually think there is a bit of an excuse, because he's reading a different tribe. And that's really, really hard. That is not the same as reading people in the same tribe as you. So I get both sides. I still think that he should have made the big move. And I do, like you, hate that it came down to just not knowing what production is going to do. That's a side of the whole game, possibly.
Do you think him consulting with Vakama, obviously, again, hindsight being 2020, and we know that Lockie specifically talked him into not using the advantage. Do you think he should have consulted with them, or do you think that might have alienated him further from really keeping this secret from the rest of his tribe?
Well, he clearly did seem pressured, and like, people have been on Lockie for recommending, you know, for saying don't use it. I totally get it from Lockie's perspective. Lockie could be going home if Vakama go back to
Tribal exactly Castle. He's like, no, I want to make the merge, like, don't use it.
Yeah, and Lockie especially has worked with Dave in the past, so they don't, like, we have so much information. This is our bird's eye view. Our bird's eye view is, well, now I know they would have merged. We know that Nick could bring over a Lee or a Shan, which is something we can discuss. We know that there's no other inroads on Makuta. So they don't know that, you know, like they're not on that tribe, and they do get blindsided once they get on the same page. But just looking across the aisle at the other tribe, they don't know that there's going to be no way to fracture it, that there's no way to work with people they've worked with in the past. And obviously they don't know what production is going to do. So it really is a tough one. What it comes down to for me when analyzing Harry's decision is, A, would he have gone home? Because I actually think he would have been okay. I think the fact that AK saved the advantage for him meant that AK was with Shawnee and Harry. And in that case, is Nick a more important ally to him than Brooke or Lockie, and possibly alienating the one of Brooke or Lockie who they don't vote out? Because if that's true, right, then he should definitely give it to Nick, because then even if they, like, it's still a hard spot, because then if Nick plays it and they don't merge, then he's at a point where he has to throw the challenge so that Nick doesn't go back to Tribal Council, vote out an ally, alienate another ally, but get back to Nick. I don't know how much more valuable Nick was than Brooke or Lockie, and to do that and to put himself in danger with no protection, but I do think Nick was maybe the most valuable person for him in the game, so there is some merit to that. But look at what we're asking. We're asking him to possibly delay a merge, to throw a challenge, to put himself in danger, to vote out an ally and alienate another one. Not a good position for Harry.
Well, not to mention, I think you talked about this a little bit on Talking Tribal, that like maybe bringing Nick into the merge, maybe he brings Sharn and Lee with him, but I don't know. The more I look at this merge situation, the more I really feel like, you know, if it ends up being that they do delay to vote and then, you know, they vote out one of Brooke or Lockie, it's still going to be 7v5. You know, there really is no way to break up that seven if you have only one more vote. I think what
even if they do merge now, it's still 7-6. I mean, Sean and Lee are obviously at that point the swing vote. Nick in my ex interview was like, I would have had a plan and I would have brought them over. Sean, I have to go against Nick here. There's no way Sean is helping Nick. No. He hasn't helped him so far. I do not believe Sean would have been with him.
No, and Lee is the only reason, the only way would be if Nick says, Sean, you come over with Moana. Like, I fundamentally believe now, and we haven't seen it because, again, it references an off-season friendship, but I fundamentally believe Sean is not going to make a move without Moana anymore, especially since now that she's not playing both sides.
But then Lee becomes a swing vote. So do you think Lee would have been with Nick or with Sean?
See, it's really tough. Lee is so fascinating here. And I will say, again, we'll get more into the editing later on. I feel like episode 15 was a step in the right direction, in my opinion. And maybe we credit it to Dave's immunity system that he had fundamentally much less to say, two octaves lower. And we got to actually hear more from Lee and Zach as a result, who are in such powerful positions. Lee's POV is so interesting to me because he says, you know, the reason why I didn't win season one is because I didn't make enough big moves. No, Lee, that is not the reason at all. Lee, you were in control of the entire post-merge. You played, in my opinion, one of the better games we have seen in this series so far. The problem was when you got to the end, you did not own that whatsoever. Like, do not worry about duplicity, my friend, whether you did it or not intentionally. You were betraying people left and right. It's just a matter of owning up to it. So I'm kind of a little, I don't know, unnerved about the fact that he almost took the wrong lesson from his season and feels like he almost needs to needlessly flip around and make big moves because that's how you win the game. When he really came close to winning at the end, where he didn't really make many big moves. He just was constantly one step ahead of everybody else in his first season.
But he's played a very different game this time, and he's been a bit of a follower, which I actually think works for him. Like, you know, he's likable. He's more likable than a lot of people in that majority. He could sit probably next to a few of them who are less likable by a jury. And I think he has good relationships. Like, I think that could be enough in a final two. So I don't hate the way he's playing now, but I do, like, you worry about the mentality where it's like, yeah, not the best awareness on what he did. Obviously, he got invalidated by 8 jurors, so he's trying to, like, work out where he went wrong, but he's kind of not, you know, in the right thinking with that, which is weird because he's, like, best friends with the person who led that jury vote now, so he should just ask him and be like, what did I do wrong? And Nick will be like, you just know your game, man. Like, just, you know, just next time. Anyway, we get what Lee did wrong in the first season, but, yeah.
Do you think maybe, you know, we talked before about poor Lee being, like, misled on the first vote, still voting for Michelle. Do you think I'll have a rant prepared later about Lockie's argument at, you know, the merge tribal council. But do you think he took those words to heart and he was like, oh, I guess I need to be making big moves. Okay, I'll really move forward on that. Thank you, Mr. Lockie. I'm going to get your vote at the end of the game. Maybe he just really took that advice and ran too far with it.
In terms of at what vote?
Like, figuring out, like, okay, I guess I need to make big moves. That's what Lockie said. He's not going to vote for someone who doesn't make big moves. I guess I better start flipping.
I don't know. Like, everything he's saying is a tribal council, which is theater. They were never going to flip at any point this week.
He even said that in his voting confessional, right? He basically said, it appears, like, I think Harry said a jury bill that, like, he feels like Zach was definitely entertaining the notion, but Lee says in his voting confessional flat out, like, yeah, I was never going to go along with this. Sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, you can say it all you want, and, like, it's a good thing to say, but we haven't heard a lot of his confessionals. We don't really know where Lee's head is at in the game, and we certainly haven't seen him make, like, any big moves, like, which is fine. I'm just, like, it wouldn't have been a big move to get to a merge of a 6 and a 6 with Lee in the middle. He has to make a big move, because he is, like, the swing vote then. He's basically just choosing between Nick and Sean. So it wouldn't have even been, like, a big move for the sake. It would have just been, like, you have to choose a side. Your two closest allies are probably on two either sides, and you're the swing vote. I don't know with Lee, like, the more I look at it, I think they wouldn't have been blindsided Vakuma if they had Nick, because he would have been like, Dave's running the show. It would have been a very different makeup. They would have been trying to swing Lee, and that's what we would have watched at the merge. And I don't know if they would have won. I don't know if Lockie goes home anyway. They don't have an idol to protect them, so the blindside isn't crucial.
Remember the fact that Lee's gonna be, you know, would he really swing over to three people that voted off all of his allies too? You know, that essentially, you know, forced him into joining up with this Vakuma 7. You can imagine, again, if the name of the game apparently of this season is Revenge Baby, to quote Skinny Ryan from Pearl Islands, you can imagine that still stings in Lee's eyes, and he's like, I don't want to work with you.
He seems like the only person on the season who's not like, revenge. I don't know. I just think that it would have been Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about his other connections, so I can only really speak to, does Nick win out over Sean? He might have, yeah, closer relationships with the rest of Makuta now, although he has voted against Mo, and he has kind of been on that side in the past, so I'm not sure. But what I do know is that I do not trust that whatever Nick was going to do, whatever he thinks was going to happen, I do not trust, and I will never trust that Sean would have had Nick's back. I think Lee could have been a swing vote. So I think it was dire anyway. I think that a lot of people kind of looking at what Harry did were very angry. You know, it was frustrating. It was so frustrating because I think a lot of people just assumed they couldn't see any reason that Harry wouldn't do this because it wasn't really hugely explained to us. Like, we just saw Vakama say, like, don't put us in trouble or whatever, like, without Harry getting a confession of being like, well, production won't tell me what's going to happen. And yeah. I don't know, you know, like, so he, that couldn't be explained to the audience. So it just looks like he held onto a piece of paper for no reason, which is nonsensical. But I think there is sense to it. And while I still think he should have made the move, I get the fear. I get just trying to get to that merge, considering Harry got to the merge in season 4 in a minority and got to final 3. I get that he backs himself, and unfortunately he couldn't deliver on that. And it was a more dire situation than he ever could have possibly imagined at the merge as well, which coming from a 4-3-2 at Makuta is a little crazy, which how on the outs Dave was from their alliance is a little crazy. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, also, like, it feels like Nick said to Shawnee, Dave is running the show. At the reward that Shawnee and Brooke came on. So
right.
What happened with that? I'm still confused. Like, that's actually something I'm going to talk to Harry in the exit interview later, but I'm going to be like, we got that you got the message that Nick was on the bottom, but was the message not delivered that Dave is running the show? And I also feel like Dave's mannerisms at that reward versus, like, at the merge were very different. I can't believe that they were so swindled by Dave at the merge. They already knew he was the mole. On original Vakama. He's acting like, he acted obviously well enough to swindle them, but they were so blindsided to the point where Lockie in his jury villa is like, did Brooke turn on me? Like, no, like, it's the guy that you knew was the mole originally. And when Brooke says to Mo, like, what's happening with the tribe? And Mo's like, oh, we're all really tight, but Dave's on the outs, poor old Dave. It's like, would Mo really be saying that if you were her enemy and it was true? Would she give you that information? Like, I can't believe that they fell from what our perspective looks really, really obvious.
Well, before we move on to the merge, I just want to point out one quick thing, because while we might decry production's vagueness about the non-elimination advantage, I would like to say that just as a concept, I am all for this. In fact, Shannon, I would go so far as to say, I think moving forward in Australian Survivor, put one of these powers in the pre-merge and one in the post-merge, and those are your non-elimination episodes.
Instead of idols. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're just instead
well, they are
of,
a type
instead
of idol.
Planning,
like, you save yourself, but you also save everyone else.
Right, but I would say instead of planning out these non-elimination episodes, you know, of like, we're going to do this big, crazy thing, and it'll prove that nobody goes home, but someone will go back to camp angry. I think that, you know, I've said this a lot, beat this drum many, many times, that my favorite element, a commonality of a lot of great Survivor twists and advantages is this idea of choice, that someone is making the decision to do something that feels best for them or somebody else in the moment. And as we talked about, either it's going to work in their favor or it's not going to. And I feel like putting that in their hands, yes, to your brother's point, it may force production to do a little bit of a hurry up or call an audible on some things. But I find that super interesting. Like, imagine, you know, if they had this back during the swap and someone like Abby goes to tribal council and is like, okay, I guess I better use this because I might be in trouble here. And then, oh, your hand is forced awkwardly. Then maybe you were going home. I think that unfortunately we saw some like possible what ifs pop up. And I think just the short time frame really didn't help things either. That really got introduced an episode before it was possibly going to be used. I really would have liked to see if he had like 7 or 8 rounds to use this, you know, how it could be utilized. I just think I'd much rather have this than some weird, contrived, twisty way to throw someone not going home in.
I don't think it's possible. Like, while I like that thought, I don't think that that would be, like, actually possible, because there's a reason that they gave him 2 tribal councils to use it in. Like, as much as they want to, you know, give the power to the players, it still has to be constrained. If he can just use it at any time in the pre or post merge, like, how do challenges work? Do they have to, like, add another thing on every single challenge? Like, they have to know, have some sense of the structure of the season. When will the merge be? When will the swap be? Like, how many people do we have in the game? So even if they have, like, those big things, like, landmarked out.
It's a, it's a, it's a little easier for pre-merge, right? Because you can just be like, okay, we'll sit, you know, you can still sit people out.
Yeah, that's
true. You don't need to necessarily
have a... You can
still
swap and merge at the same time every time, which is obviously what they were going to do anyway. It would be hard to control.
And have the post-merge expire at, like, the final seven, because they'd love to do it then anyway. You know,
but
what if no one ever uses it as well?
Then you don't have the one elimination episode. Then we're going to have two episodes at the end of the season. They're going to crown a winner. I have two episodes left where... What, just Dave confessionals from old seasons?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you could do a clip show or do like a secret scenes thing, like shit they should have shown, like they do on the challenge, where they just show a bunch of all the cold opens, which I have loved, by the way. I love the advent of the cold opens on Australian Survivor because they're so damn kooky and fun. And maybe just fill an episode full of that. I know,
that's not the solution to non-elimination episodes, and have just clip shows. We can't, like... That's not going to compete with Married at First Sight.
Listen, I'm a Survivor historian. I remember warmly tuning in on a Thanksgiving Thursday to watch, you know, Survivor Africa clip show. So maybe that's just warming the cockles of my nostalgic heart.
The clip shows of Australian Survivor literally would just be Dave confessionals. Do you think that, like, Jackie gets a look in the clip show or not?
No, I think we get a full out like Cooking with Jackie segment. You know, I feel like maybe it would be like Makuta TV where we see all the various shows that they did.
Does that count in like Edgic, the clip show? I don't, did Edgic exist then? Yes. I'm trying to think of it.
Yeah, I was a child. The clip show wasn't for strategy stuff. It was a lot of camp life stuff. It was basically like, hey, here's a bunch of random ass things that happened that weren't able to make the main show because they weren't really that pertinent to the storylines. So it was more so like superfluous fun, which I'm all about, especially on a show like Australian Survivor, where you have so much time that like, surprise, surprise, especially this season, things are making the cutting room floor somehow. Maybe you can find a reason to push that Flick content onto a clip show, you know?
Poor Flick. Yeah, poor Flick. I think, honestly, I think being relegated to the clip show is like worse than nothing. It's just terrible. It's like bad edging. It's like, why have they not shown them in the real show? Yeah, I mean, I also like the advantage. I think that giving it that much scope would be a headache for production. I do think it could be in at least every pre-merge because it is kind of like an idol. They do have to have some modicum of control over it. I just, as much as I liked it, I like so many things about it, and I love that it had this interesting strategic decision. I just wish that decision wasn't based on production. Harry should not have to be thinking what we were debating this week. Well, would the merge, but what were they, would they delay the merge? And well, they've merged at 12 the last three seasons, so would we always merge at 12? Like, this is not a conversation Harry needs to be having with Shawnee or himself or AK or, you know, like that is too stressful.
Speaking of the merge, so yeah, again, you know, I think we're gonna have our gripes with editing. I will say, and maybe I'm in the minority on this one, I actually really liked the story of the merge episode, and maybe the placement wasn't right because we have been getting so much Dave with the Phoebe and the Nick quote unquote blindsides with the heaviest damn quotes available. That, you know, to have him be the narrator of the merge episode felt like a bit rote. But I've realized, Shannon, that I think my favorite episodes of Australian Survivor, I like to call them heist episodes, where in the first act of the episode, they establish, okay, my plan for this vote is I want to do this and get rid of this person. And over the course of the episode, we see it slowly, surely, and methodically get carried out. I love, for example, the Henry blindside in season two with the formation of the Champagne Alliance, like all of Henry's connections just coming together in the worst way possible to blindside him. The Matt blindside in season three was really great as well with the fall of the Godfather and like really making sure that Sharn finds an idol in front of everybody, but we have to make sure she doesn't play it the right way. We even saw one earlier this season, episode three, which has been hailed as like one of the best episodes of all time with the Daisy blindside. We saw every piece of that come together. And I really liked what they did here as well. Yes, you could have stopped the episode after the first act and known exactly what happened because David essentially outlined what they were going to do exactly. But I actually enjoyed a lot of it being carried out. It sucked to see Vakama, you know, being swindled. But they, you know, at least made things entertaining by really building up the cocky locky of it all and making him Kat Ederson style relish in the art of a blindside before he gets blindsided himself.
I wasn't as high on it. And let me go back to all the examples that you just gave. Daisy boot, Matt boot, the Henry boot. What do those three things have that this did not have? Stakes. There was an idol in every situation that could have saved
that
person.
I'm pretty sure there were stakes on, I don't know, no, it was chicken on that merge table, not stakes. You were right.
Yes, exactly. So this had no stakes at all. Like, Loki and Vakama are sitting ducks. Was it duck at the merge fees? Whatever it is, they are five that are going home. And I think it was why I just found it more lackluster than all of the amazing episodes you just described, is because what could they have done? Like, it makes complete sense. Like, a lot of people are like, why did Dave and Zach make this move? It's so cruel. Vakama on the bottom anyway. Like, of course they should blindside their opponents. The other side could have an idol. The other side should have had an idol. Production should definitely be hiding an idol at both camps. I can't believe the cake reward could have that much strategic relevance, just winning that one swimming challenge. But if there's an idol and Loki finds out it's him, that's why Sean has to go to AK and give him the wrong name. That's why Dave has to, you know, and Zach have to say, we're on your side, so that Loki's blindsided, so that if that side don't have an idol, which they easily could have, you know, that could screw over Makuta. If it bounces back on them, if they've chosen the right target in Vakama, if they've chosen someone who won't be protected by an idol. So they have to do the blindside strategically, I see, from Makuta's perspective. From a viewer perspective, we know that Vakama have nothing. We know that even if they were to find out what happened, they wouldn't have an idol, they wouldn't have an inroad, they wouldn't have anything. So my heart was racing during the Henry boot, for example, because if he's tipped off even a little bit, if the acting isn't perfect, then he's playing his idol and the plan is gone. But if they're tipped off here, Vakama, what happens? Like, Loki just goes to Ponderosa or to Jury Villa, not being so confused. So the stakes weren't that high for me. It was a very long episode, obviously. It was a lot of the same content. And yes, if Vakama has an idol and this whole thing is predicated on how well can they blindside, are they going to play the idol on AK? Are they going to not play the idol at all? Because they really do wish they did desperately believe that they have the numbers. Yes, my heart is racing. That just takes one errant comment for the whole thing to blow up. But now there was no way to blow up. It was definitely happening. They had absolutely no option. So it wasn't as fun for me.
Well, yeah, I guess you're sort of comparing it to like a ninja assassin versus like mugging an old lady, right?
Talking about the old ladies. It's like, please leave my old ladies alone. I genuinely teared up watching them all hold hands in that last vote read.
They're the musicians on the Titanic, right?
They're the ones that are like, who said that? Was it AK? I think it was AK who was like, I'm going down with this Titanic. Actually, I could cry thinking about it. It's so beautiful. And I'm so sad. I'm so heartbroken that this is happening to Vakama. I genuinely like every person in Vakama.
Well, you can't spell Titanic without AK as well if you misspell it.
So true.
It really is a part of it. But yeah, I think maybe one thing that I do appreciate about it, and about the through line in all these episodes in general, is I'm just a fan of when we deviate from the norm when it comes to editing, because we're used to, for the longest time, Survivor storytelling saying, okay, it could be person A, but maybe it's person B, when we know a good, at least 70% of the time, like, it was always definitively person A, and they're just throwing person B in there to throw a little bit of doubt. Like, people were not really changing their minds at all. So I always appreciate when they make things a little bit more straightforward, and so it becomes more of a tragedy. That being said, from an emotional perspective, it was very tragic. I mean, say what you want to about Loki, I will certainly disagree with the things he was saying at what ultimately would be his final tribal council before the final tribal council. But yeah, it does suck to see, you know, these really crafty, fun players, especially those who like had this really emotional vote out of Flick, like they've really come together as a group, you know, and they're sort of formed their own little family, sort of start to get picked apart by this Makuta.
Yeah, I mean, let me clarify. I wouldn't change the edit. Like, I don't want them to make Dave, like, to Frankenby Dave being like, I don't know which side I'm going to go on. You know that I hate that lack of transparency from the edit to, like, the point where they're lying to the viewer. I just think that it was a really boring vote. Like, there's nothing the edit can do at that point. And maybe that does speak right to just where we are in the game. And but then it frustrates me because I do think a lot of that is on production for not hiding an idol at Vakama. And for some of this cast that it's just like, yeah, maybe if Benji is Zach, maybe Benji actually is flipping. Who knows what Benji is doing? Benji is crazy. Benji would be amazing casting. So just based on like the flaws that I find in the season so far, kind of build up to what makes this a boring vote. I don't blame the edit. Like, they showed it as it was. They didn't lie to us. Thank you for not lying to us. Unfortunately, the truth was that this was boring and sad, and they were mugging my friends and my old lady friends. The Titanic with a K. Yeah.
I always remember on the Titanic when they were mugging all those old ladies, dropping their jewels into the ocean. One thing that I really
did enjoy.
Very untold
story of the Titanic. No one talked about that.
Exactly. This story they don't want you to know about, all those old lady muggings.
Is there not space for Vakama on the door, though? Like, I think there's space on the door for Vakama.
No, see, there was, but then they had to merge early, and there aren't 13 spots on the door, Shannon, only 12. And so they had to, you know, change things up at the last minute. One thing I really want to pick up about the merge episode is I really loved, I talked about the bird stuff before, but I really love this Shawnee scene, just because I think we're always trying to wrap our minds around, like, in Survivor, how do you talk about the social game without just it being like, oh, yes, person A talks to person B about their families and they become closer together. And I really love this scene with Shawnee weaponizing her bonds, but especially her being very specific with Brooke about, like, OK, you're going to talk with Zach, but make sure it is not about strategy. It's that you're connecting over personal details. Like, I think that is the most succinct, clean way I've seen a social game be represented. It sucks because, you know, Shawnee's game is unfortunately on her toes right now. But I love the way that they showed that, because that's really what it comes down to in terms of relationship building, is not necessarily building relationships over writing down names on pieces of parchment together. It's just sharing personal details and connecting with people, especially when you're meeting for the first time, like Brooke and Zach.
And you know what? I like that Zach saves birds. OK, I'll say it. I like that he rescues birds. I love animals. I'm a vegetarian. And that is a really endearing quality about Zach. Yeah, and that's, I guess, the first positive thing I've said about Zach 5 weeks into the podcast. Yeah, I mean, it was good. It was the Shawnee-Zach relationship is someone that's so interesting across two seasons, don't you think? Like, yeah. The fact that they had that, like, the animosity on season three, but then they've, like, worked together a little bit, but also worked against each other in their first tribe on this season. Now I've come back, and she is the one who thinks she can get Zach back. Is really interesting. Like, I do hope, like, that Zach maybe works with Shawnee again, because I like that relationship. I like that it's kind of this, like, frenemy relationship, and I want Shawnee to be okay.
That's the thing. That's what I feel like is actually the major out for, unfortunately, not necessarily the Vakama alliance, but Shawnee majorly. I could very much see a situation, because we've seen this in seasons 1, 3, and 4. 75% of Australian Survivor seasons so far have, like, started off their merge with, like, a pretty basic picking off of the other alliance before the majority alliance starts to splinter a bit and they start to pick up some of their stragglers. And maybe this is me writing fan fiction, but damn it, if this isn't a good piece of fan fiction, I could see it get to a point where, you know, maybe it's quite literally Makuta and Shawnee left, or like Shawnee and AK, because I can imagine Brooke gets taken down next for being a challenge threat. But I could see, to your point, something where we see Dave be very leery of Sharn. Maybe they use that opportunity and Zach worked his relationship with Shawnee to be like, okay, we're going to pick up, you know, Shawnee and AK, and we're going to stage a coup and take out Sharn because we're super afraid that she's going to turn on us later on. And that cracks the game a little bit wider. Is it completely bursting the game wide open? I don't think so. And does it displace Dave from a seat of power? Probably not. But I think there's an opportunity there. And I think if there's anyone to crack it, it will be someone like Shawnee, who, yes, she won the first individual immunity challenge in 3 minutes, but just by the grace of her being Shawnee, I still feel like, you know, her and Brooke have won the same number of challenges this season, but I feel like Brooke is still by far the bigger threat. Like, Shawnee's just Shawnee, and people are going to love her for it. And as a result, she's going to be able to be brought in on those votes. I agree. I hope it is as well. I mean, in general, I love these relationships that have warped and changed over the course of these couple seasons. We talked about Nick and Lee. I think the unfortunate thing with Nick and Lee, and I wish we had seen more of it, it's actually comparable to me of, like, the rumor that Jerry and Colby made up one night in Survivor Heroes versus Villains. And people are very angry about that because that's the culmination of all their storylines. And I was talking about that on the Survivor Historians podcast when we covered Heroes versus Villains. And Mario Lanza brought up an interesting point, which was like, yeah, that's good and all in terms of their overall arcs, but that didn't pertain at all to the overall narrative of Heroes versus Villains. And so it wasn't in there. And so I guess, yeah, when you look at it, like, it would have been nice to see Nick and Lee come back together to have a personal moment where, like, they connected with one another over, I guess, having children, or like where they've come in their lives between seasons. But unfortunately, you know, seeing where Nick placed and where Lee is now, it just had no bearing whatsoever on the through line of the story. And with the very straightforward way that this season appears to be edited, that means it's going to make the flick clip show.
What about AK and Lockie? like, you know, especially like Lockie went to Jury Villa and he's saying how like his two closest allies really were Brooke and AK, and Brooke didn't even know how close he was with AK. That is really like fun and crazy that that's where their story went. I wouldn't have expected it from either of those pairs. I definitely was like, when I told Nick to work with Lee, like it was more like, it's going to be cagey, but like you should definitely try and like no one will see it coming. Not just like they would just love each other. I didn't think it would be that easy. So I have really enjoyed like watching those evolutions kind of from the side. But, you know, looking at, you know, what's to come, we definitely got a lot of questions about that. Yeah, someone is screwed. Someone from the Vakuma 3 is definitely screwed. I would say probably AK, because I think he's always a threat. The way they've taken out kind of Harry now for being such a strategic threat, I think AK just looks like a natural follow-on from that. They've also split the votes on AK here, so that makes it seem like he would be a target. They also, he was the decoy vote at the merge, they should bring up his name.
Let's talk about that for a second, right? Because I would say, again, you know, episode 15, pretty straightforward. They tried to do the Sean Hampton Memorial hurry up before Tribal Council. I really liked actually the smoking fires, like the smoldering embers behind people as they were doing confessionals. But alas, they were not able to buck the Makutas. But the Makutas decide to split their votes 5-2. Mm-hmm. And I know that we've both been asked about this. And I think
so
we both
much.
Tried
you
to.
You definitely have to explain it. Yeah. You've got a lot of questions.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, so let's talk about that. Why do you think, let's try to fill our own headcanon in and not just, you know, Bakuda likes the number two, so they decide to throw two votes onto AK for no particular reason. One for each letter, I suppose.
Well, I'm pretty certain it's one of these two things because it's like there's a lot of precedence for either one. Either they're going champion style from season four, the champions never wasted votes. And people could call this risky, but if you look at the vote reads on 10 play, like no one was flipping and it was correct of Makuta to read it that it was that safe that they could split votes. So they don't waste any votes. They put five votes on their target because it's a 5-4, put two votes on a different target. And then if Vakuma do turn against each other, start pushing each other off the door, which probably they should have done, but I'm human. They held hands. I get it. It was too hard. But I mean, at a point, they're going to have to start really throwing each other under the bus. But if they do turn on each other, then it becomes a legitimate split. That's one option. What I think is actually more likely is it was a move we've actually seen created by AK, now used against AK. This was created by AK at the Daisy vote, and we didn't discuss it at the time. He's since clarified on Twitter because I asked him about it. What this move is, and it's never going to be explained because it's never going to be explained on the show because it's way too complicated and it doesn't have any payoff. But it's
same
actually
for the Flick Clip Show.
This is like, oh, I love this stuff. I really do love this stuff. So what this is a counter to the minority split vote. A history lesson. Nick Wilson invented the minority split in David versus Goliath because if the minority
Harry's favorite player.
Yes, and if for some reason Harry didn't do it when he should have at the John vote, and we talked about it at the time in season four. But when the minority have an idol, if this minority did have an idol, then they should split the vote because if seven votes are coming for, say, Harry, and then four votes come back at Jackie and Dave plays and Harry plays an idol and Dave plays an idol for Jackie, it's 0-0 and you go back and re-vote and the majority wins. If the minority split the vote and put two votes on a Mo Hope, for example, then their two votes went out. It's 2-0-0. That's a minority vote split. What AK invented and what I think was employed here was the counter to that by the majority, which is to put two votes on AK. Then if Mo Hope gets two votes and it's 0-0-2, there's another two votes on AK. They go back and they re-vote and AK goes home. So it's just in case the minority have an idol, which, you know, if they did have an idol, and knowing AK as I really believe I do, if Harry has an idol, they're definitely splitting their votes because there's no reason to put four votes on to a majority member. Like you're thinking that you're going to win out with an idol. It was pretty obvious that Harry was going home. So if you're going to win out, you might as well split your vote and have as many options as you want and just kind of make the most of your four votes rather than randomly piling on four votes onto someone to win in what would be a 4-0. So yeah, 2-0-0 is what they wanted to do, but then the majority counter split. I hope this is making sense, but I really enjoy this. It hasn't paid out in the two times it's been used if this was it, but it makes me giddy.
No, I really love this because this is really like fourth dimensional, like Vizini and Princess Bride. Like, what are you expecting me to do that you expect me to do? Just going back and forth in terms of displacing your psychology. And yeah, I mean, I think to be quite honest, it was, I guess, like too long, didn't listen. The majority put two votes on just in case the minority split their votes 2-2 so that there would be a tie if two idols were played.
Yeah.
Though I guess I mean, and I guess...
Because AK would have done that. Like, it predicates on Harry not having an idol, which, again, we know right. he doesn't, but they don't know that he hasn't found one or whatever in the last 3 days, or he didn't have one before. That he does.
Yeah, considering his reputation, you'd assume that he'd have, like, 5 at this point. And, you know, you do wonder, like, okay, if Harry does play an idol, would David play his idol on Jackie? But, I mean, he's got an idol burning a hole in his pocket with one in reserve, and especially...
And they know the target, because Lee yeah. and Zach are actually on their side, so...
Right, and you know, I think actually maybe in retrospect, I, like you said last week, was not a big fan of him pulling the idol out in that moment, just because there was nobody coming for him in that moment, and he could have very well had painted an opportunity for other people to be like, okay, let's just flush this idol, and you know, either we flush the idol or he goes home with it in his pocket again, which I think Nick was trying to do in the beginning of his final episode. But now that Makuta has really solidified themselves for the moment as a 7, I actually think it was a great thing to do, because now not only are people not coming for David with his safety around him, but he can actually, you know, put himself as the leader of this tribe of like, you can't get rid of me because I have the idol. I have the thing that can protect us and make sure we get to the final 7. So I definitely thought he would have done it, because also he would have done it in a big, like, elaborate fashion. Maybe he'd get down on one knee and like propose to Jackie using the idol in like a heart shaped box or something. But I think it's something he would have done to be charitable. And definitely also because he had another one that nobody knew about that he would very easily be able to use for his own selfish gains later on.
It does mean, though, that that's not his decision anymore. Like, he has an idol that his whole alliance knows about. They know the target. If Harry plays an idol, he has to play it for Jackie. Otherwise, he's like a terrible ally and they'll all turn against him. So he does kind of give up some of that power, whereas if he just has the idol himself, he can kind of make that decision by himself. I still think pros and cons. I mean, this is a man who got blindsided with an idol in his pocket. I still think, like, it's a scary thing to kind of give people that information, but it's definitely working for him so far. I don't have a lot of problems with what Dave is doing. Like, I know that some people, you know, were upset about, again, like, why would you alienate jurors by blindsiding them at the merge? It's like, you have to blindside your opponent. Only we know that they don't have an idol. People have issues with Lee and Zach. Why didn't you flip? It's like, they shouldn't flip yet. It's only the final, what is it, 11?
11, yeah.
10 now, like... It's been one vote since the merge. This is not the time. I truly think, like, you think Brooke, I think AK. One of them is completely screwed. Can't spell screwed without AK. No, you actually really can. There's no A or K in screwed.
Scrawd.
Yeah, he's in a bad spot. And, or Brooke's in a bad spot, or Shawnee's in a bad spot. But I do think once it gets down to two of them, something can happen, because then it won't be, like, then it's definitely not a block at all. Then it takes it down, you know, to fewer numbers. At that point, maybe a Dave or a Sean or someone's going against each other and possibly using those numbers. But that is my hope. That's not going to be a straight begonging. But I do think in the next episode, someone is legitimately screwed.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page of, like, I think next week people are like being like, oh, great, it's just going to be Brooke, AK, Shawnee, Boots in whatever order over the next week.
Ooh, that would suck so hard, Mike. I can't.
It would suck so hard, but I'm going to be optimistic here, finally bringing in that optimism that you wanted, and say I don't think that's going to be the case. Because
I brought in some optimism. I love the count as a minority vote split. That's like the most excited I've been all week, other than Lockie being made the Bachelor. Those are the two things that get me really excited.
Oh, my God. Well, we have to talk about that later on. But before we get into
those
that,
are two
I guess
such random
Lockie,
and disparate things, but they're my two favorite things that happened this week.
So I want to talk about the tribal council, though, that Lockie ended up going home in, because you know what? I enjoy Lockie. I understand that, like, he definitely did not have fans in his first season by sort of representing that big, macho, hard-headed bro guy. But I thought he was fine in his second season, but he did not leave a good taste in my mouth leaving Shannon. And like you said, with the theatrics of Tribal Council, maybe part of it was for show, him trying to convince people to jump over and join his side. But I just was beating my forehead into my laptop as he kept going on and on about how, if I'm a juror, I'm not going to vote for anyone who plays a safe game. You better be making big moves and blindsides every single time or you're not getting my vote.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of have a rule where it's like, unless it's in confessional, and even in Australian Survivor, maybe even then, because who knows what's been...
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, unless they tell me directly and it feels legit, I don't know if
unless
I believe
unless you stare
it.
Into my eyes unblinking for an uninterrupted sentence on Australian Survivor and tell me what your plan is, I'm not going to believe you at face value.
Pretty much. I mean, definitely not a tribal council where, like, as Jamal would say, like, there's a lot of theater. I don't think it's as much theater as Jamal seemed to think it was, but I do think that... Like, there is strategic merit to Lockie being like, don't just stay as the Makuta 7, then I would be going home. You can't be doing that. So I right. kind of get
the,
it.
It's the Sierra in Cambodia, right? They're like, you've got to make big moves, which is subtext for you've got to flip to benefit my game.
Yeah. But like, what else are they meant to say? I don't know so much for Lockie because I feel like if someone's saying that at the Harry boot, then it's like definitely all theater because they know how screwed they are. Lockie and the Vakuma really thought that they were fine. It's actually chilling. Like, you have to go watch, if anyone who hasn't, go watch the voting confessionals. They all thought they were in so good. And the fact that Lockie is so blindsided at Drury Villa, where he's like genuinely questioning if Brooke played him the whole time, yeah. Instead of it being
falls
Zach
to
and
his
Dave,
knees. Like, he's in the Shawshank Redemption screaming to the sky, who voted for me?
I can't believe they were that blindsided by it. Like, knowing that they knew, there's two question marks. Knowing that they knew that Dave was the mole, I don't know how they fully trusted him. Like, they're desperate. There's nothing else they could do. I get the desperation, but I just can't believe they were that blindsided because they know that Dave is so shifty. The other person is Zach. That's not a great situation. And also, like, I have to ask Harry in, like, a couple of hours from now, like, what did Shawnee and Brooke bring back from the reward when Nick said Dave is running the show? Did that not compute? Was that, as Pia said last week, a subtitle that was incorrectly given to us? Like, I get that they got that Nick was on the bottom, but I just don't know how they thought that Dave... like, where they thought Dave was. And I just can't, for the life of me. Like, you have to think about what's realistic. Like, in that tribal council on Heroes vs. Villains, I always go back to it. Like, the story that Russell gave the heroes for how Parvati was still there right. when he should have idled her out. And he was like, two idols are played. Like, it was the best tribal council literally in history. Didn't sound believable, although in Modern Survivor, who knows. But, like, yeah, is it believable that Dave was just vulnerable and bobbing along and on the bottom? Oh, poor Dave is a bit of an outsider, but they didn't vote out Dave. They had him exactly where they wanted him, and they voted out, I mean, even Nick, and I love Nick, and he's a big threat. But you're taking out Dave if he's really on the bottom. So, I don't know. I know they saw 4-3-2. I know they thought it was confusing. That would have been for definitely like a Harry and an AK, surely something they were overanalyzing of, like, who voted where, something that we as Twitter did a lot of, harder on the island with no information, but I just don't understand how they were that sure that Dave, of all people, was with them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really speaks to, and this is unfortunately one of the bigger problems with Dave's edit, is because there's so much of him in confessional, I feel like we really, it's weird to say, I don't think you and I are doing this, but maybe the Survivor Collective in general is actually kind of underrating his game. In that,
he's pretty good. Like, I think he's really, really good.
Well, I don't know though, because I think we're used to him doing like these big bombastic things in confessionals, but from what it really sounds like he is much more underhanded in person when you're at camp. And maybe he was just able to really play up that reputation to the other Vakumas when they get back. And maybe they're like, oh yeah, I guess his tail's tucked between his legs. Like, I guess he really was castrated by over there on Makuta. He really does want to work with us. And I wish we could see that. I have many, many, many sticking points with the Dave confessionals. And one of them is that I actually wish we saw more of him at camp instead of him sneaking Jim Halpert looks to the camera or making Derek Zoolander references, you know, because that's what's going to win him the game. Not him bragging to us in confessionals, as entertaining as it might be. It's actually him making these plays and deceiving people at camp. And I have to imagine that was a large portion. I also know that Harry gave major props on Reddit to Zach for doing this as well. So it seems like both of them were just putting in like Oscar worthy work, so much so that Harry's going to give his fake baby away. Literally Oscar worthy.
I don't want to underrate it. I think Dave is playing one of the best games of all time so far. Like, if you look at the resume through 5 weeks of the show, the Matt connection and that whole innovative thing was so genius. And yes, he was found out being the mole, and yes, he might have been saved by a swap, but you know, peaks and valleys in the game of Australian Survivor. That connection with Matt Rogers got him in with Mo, got him into the point where it definitely could have been him over Phoebe or Nick. Like, it definitely could have been Lee and Sean and Mo. Like, in a world where he doesn't have connection with Matt Rogers, the Mo contingent and Lee and Sean have him right where they want him. Until he has an idol, he'd definitely be voted out. He finds two idols. He manipulates Phoebe. It's some of the best manipulation I've ever seen. And in her ex interview with me, I said, Dave, he seems so different to us. Like, he was so mad at you after the tribal council, and she didn't pick up on anything because he was like emotionally so there for her. So that's incredible acting, incredible manipulation. The Nick blindside, like, whatever. I mean, it's not a blindside at all, but like, If anything, I think that was one of his weaker parts in the game, because while he had all the numbers, which is a credit to him completely, I think he thought he was blindsiding Nick, and he actually wasn't. He would have been blindsided by Nick's vote for Zach, which is a small win, and it's just one vote, but I don't think his read on that situation was right. In terms of what?
I do wonder, in terms of, like, I really feel like that was more of a TV thing. Like, part of me, and maybe this is just me hoping that, like, the dude actually knows what a blindside is, and it's not just, like, if you get voted out, it's a blindside. That's not an equal sign in between those two words. I wonder if it was a thing where he's like, he knows what producers want in terms of like sound
the
bites.
The eternal
and
question with
want.
Dave. What is real and what is TV? The answer is all TV.
Like, yeah, it's like, I know if I keep talking about blindside, that they're going to love it, because that's what modern Survivor really salivates around, right? It's this idea of like surprising strategic moves that shock people to their cores. And so even when it's the complete opposite of the fact, he's going to talk it up till the cows come home, because he knows that's going to make the edit at the end of the day. And it did hard.
Yeah, but I actually do think he thought he was blindsiding Nick. And again, from us, it's like, why do you need to blindside Nick? That seems cruel. He's on the bottom. He has no options. But from his perspective, he doesn't know what Nick has. And from his perspective, which was the wrong read, but he thinks, I've brought Nick in. I told him, you know, we're voting out Jackie. I've told him we want to work together. So if he has something which Harry could have given him, in a world where he actually is blindsiding Nick, maybe Nick isn't using that advantage. But of course, Nick was onto it. And I just think Dave didn't realize that Nick was like one of the only people not to fall for his BS so far, and actually was trying to do a counter plan against him. He didn't have any of the numbers, and Dave did have that. But I think in terms of like who was reading correctly what was happening there, Nick knew that he was getting 5 to 7 votes based on like how sentimental Lee and Sean would be. And I do believe that Dave thought that Nick was voting for Jackie and thinking he was in good and was actually going to be blindsided, which was obviously not the case. So I actually think, like, I really do believe that Dave thought he was blindsiding Nick, as much as that blindside might seem unnecessary to us, but always better to blindside your opponent, as Winners at War has taught us about a week ago. So, but beyond that very, very, very tiny blind spot or blindside spot, comes into the merge, leads the entire charge, incredible acting work, hasn't had a vote against him, is in with the biggest group of goats we've seen, could be any of them at the end, and probably anyone at the end. Doesn't have a lot of great options of who will go against him. And I think so underrated, has pulled in Zach with some really active social play that we saw at the swap. And I feel like Zach's his number two. And that is a perfect person to have as your Wu or your Mateo when you want to make moves. So I don't want to underrate it. Dave is playing not just a good game, like it's a phenomenal game. You can feel like it's been too much for TV. You can feel just exhausted by it. I still think Dave's fun and a fun character, as mad as I am about the Nick stuff, but it is, I do believe, an unbelievable game.
Well, and I compare, you know, what Phoebe told you, and I feel like you're going to get to the core with, like, I'm going to make a lot of big claims as to how this season is going to go. I think it's going to be Moana versus David, and maybe that means they show down together at the final 7. Maybe it means they're facing off against each other at the final 2. But I think that answer there is the perfect reason why Dave is going to beat Moana at this game, because I mean, the move against Phoebe, is such a big kerfuffle around Dave doing this. But if you look at it, it really did seem like Moana was the one pulling the strings behind him, you know, really providing this information of like, I want to vote, you know, I voted this way. I voted her out to protect you. She was gunning for you. And it really did seem like, even though they got lost in the tidal wave of gleefully evil confessionals that Dave was giving, that Moana was the one that was really orchestrating this move. The issue is she is not behaving in camp in a way that's going to make people want to necessarily join up with her that haven't already. You know, we've been even hearing between the lines from people like AK and Harry that, like, at the merge, it really did seem like Moana's alliance, mainly herself, just did not want to give them the time of day. Those people, if your gameplay plays out the way you want to, are going to be 5 votes on the jury. In a jury that might be 9, might be 10, whatever the hell number it is, that's a huge majority. You do not want them as a block hating your guts. And I know that some people are really talking up Moana right now as a good winner alternative to Dave. I guess I could see the path, but at this moment in time, I don't know if I can, just because, and maybe it's due to her introvert personality. Maybe it's just her not necessarily giving people the time of day. I mean, when Nick told you that story in his exit interview that she took so long to open up to him. And when she did, she asked him if he has a son. When he just saw their daughter, everyone did on that television screen during the auction a couple of weeks ago. That's not a good sign, in my opinion. As much as people may be saying, oh, yeah, big players got to win this. This is all stars. We have to have the greatest big move player ever to win this game. I still fundamentally think there is going to be some ounce in there of every person's vote of like, who do I want to give this money to out of the two or three options? And the way that Moana seems to be treating people that are not in her alliance, that's going to do her a big disservice depending on who she goes up against.
Yeah, I concur. And I think that it's frustrating because it seems so easy to just like ask people basic questions about themselves. And I don't understand why you wouldn't do that in a social game. This is the whole problem with the Mocial game that Mo is playing. But I do want to say, like, we did get a question from Edward Morris who said, who do you guys believe can get to the end and can get the votes to win? And I did want to address this with Mo specifically, because from an Edda perspective, she's one of the better contenders. But you're wondering, how can Mo win? She's alienated the whole minority. They seem to have no love for her. They're going to be 5 of 10, or if there's a juror removal, 9 jurors. How can she win? And I just want to, spoilers for Survivor South Africa Philippines, but Mike, we, you know, co-hosted coverage for Survivor South Africa Philippines, and we talked about Tom Schwartz, who could never ever win because he'd alienated everyone, and no one liked him. And this is what you get with final two seasons, is that anyone can win. At this point, there's no one who can't win. Even like, take out the edit, but even like a Tarzan or whatever, especially in this group of people who are, from a goat perspective, it seems pretty even. Yes, you might really not like Moana, but I'm sure it's going to be a final two because from the episode order, what are they going to do? Another non-elimination? I would expect a final two. So if it's Mo next to a Tarzan, you may really dislike Mo but think she played a better game and she might argue it better. Like, you only need to beat one person who might have a terrible final tribal council performance who, you know, that's why like a Tarzan could beat Mo, or you know, like a Zach could beat whoever, or Mo could beat Zach, or Jackie. Like, all of these people could be up against each other one-on-one, giving different final tribal council performances, and I don't think anyone is ruled out. And I think that even as much as they don't like Mo, if she is next to someone who screwed them over more, or someone they don't think has done anything, or a Jackie who they just think has followed her, or anything like that, she could win.
I guess that's a good point, and I guess we do have some of the season left to play out. It's just tough at this point. I mean, I guess they can sort of collectively be her Palesa, right? There's someone, the person who said, I'd swear I never vote for you. And then they end up waking up in bed next to her.
It would not be nearly as delightful, I have to say. Not nearly as delightful.
Listen, there's not nearly anything in this world that can be as delightful as Survivor South Africa Philippines, just an absolute unicorn of a season. But it just, so I do agree that there are outs there. It just really, these choices confuse me. As to, because like you said, like
the choice to not ask anyone who you live with and who might be a jury vote and who you might need to work with about their life in any capacity for 2 weeks. Yeah.
Or just like, I mean, I am so excited for your deep dives because I would love to hear what happened on pre-swap Vakama. Because again, it really does sound like a lot of the foundational behavioral elements that are still striking through to emerge really started there. And this is where we get like the accusations of like Phoebe getting bullied or just like the way they were behaving in front of another. And I really want to know like what started that cold war, because it's still manifesting here. And depending on how things shake out, I mean, I guess the other thing as well is it also might depend on if Moana gets to the end of how she can spin her game. Because again, if Lockie is saying you can't play the safe game, the first 30 days of this game didn't matter, which disagree with that whole
is tribal council, Mike.
I know, but like I just want to put out there that like on principle, like I just do not believe fundamentally that this is what should make a winning Survivor game, you know. But like with him really decrying her directly, if he really does stick to that, if it isn't just theater, I wonder, you know, hopefully she'll be able to turn that around and really explain herself. I do think, you know, the smiling assassin routine worked really well last season. I think if Moana vocalizes it in a certain way, especially next to someone like Jackie, I think the scarecrow they made of Jackie can probably beat Jackie at this point in a jury vote.
So true. I don't think that someone who makes the minority on Vakama feel the way they do and as alienated as they did should win Survivor. Like, I'm all for the social game, right? And it seems like a specifically anti-social game. And this is like kind of like the double-edged sword of a final two. It's like, you know, someone like Pia can work through and she has more time to work her game, and then the bigger players get taken out and her very social game wins. But there also is the option, like, maybe just like everyone else just gets taken out by each other and you're just left with like the hangers on. and they don't have to have a very big game or a very social game. So I cannot,
right,
for my entire values of
Hello
the game,
Season 2.
Well, I like Jericho's win, but in you know, some capacity, like, that can happen in these longer games on Australian Survivor with a final two. I can't spend several years yelling into a mic about how much I value the social game and co-sign a game that does have strategic merit, and I think Mo is doing things, and I think that she has a lot more control. And I said on Talking Tribal, she's inherited Matt Rogers' game, she's inherited his relationship with Dave, his minions, and his penchant for revenge. She is the Godfather Part 2. Strategically, I get it, but I can't come out here and co-sign a game when I hear Nick on the X interview saying that she asked about his son after they watched the video. I don't have words for that.
Can we also talk about that as well, of like, this is revenge for Matt? Because again, irony of all ironies is that Matt going might have been one of the best things for Moana's game.
Because she inherited his whole game.
Yeah, because Dave, I mean, he had some outs, I guess, with the Vakuma people who believed him, but he really has nowhere to go. Like, he has Zach, yes, but if Matt was there, he would, you know, Dave would go with Matt over Marana any day of the week. That's why it made that whole decision during the Double Tribal Council even more confusing, where she's like, I want to get close to Dave. It's like, but he's already close to your closest ally. Unless she saw the writing on the wall and knew that Matt wasn't long for this game and already was making inroads, it's a relationship that paid dividends. Even JLP said in the previously on for episode 15 of, like, it cemented them forever, which makes me believe that, like, again, if this is not the final two, this is definitely a partnership that's going to become a pivotal part of the game later on. But it's just, it's very odd that she is, you know, celebrating the grave, the life of Matt Rogers, when really he left her so much great stuff in his will that, you know, his demise ended up being the best thing for her.
Yeah, she got some massive life insurance on Matt Rogers' vote out. She should be happy with what she got, because she inherited a lot of great stuff that Matt had put into place, and she's using it well. No more revenge arcs, okay? We've seen it. It's done. Everyone from season 4 is gone, Dave, God. So that's done. Unless they're getting revenge for Nick, in which case, I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Again, I love how it goes full circle, too, for this season, for Dave to be like, all right, I'm getting revenge on Harry. Like, Harry was the other vote instead of you at your vote. I know that,
yeah,
you
it's funny that it was Harry and Daisy, which were the two other people he expected to be getting votes when he got voted out.
And then an irony of all ironies, too, is that in the confessional, he's like, this is for Janine, when Janine was by far the bigger burn and turn on. Like, I guarantee you, if Janine was on this season, she is not getting a shout out from the Golden God in voting confessionals. He is slitting her throat and then some.
Yeah, Janine, like, actually blindsided him. Like, that would actually be a fitting revenge arc if she was on this season. Now, voting confessional made me sad because I was just so sad about the season, and it made me remember how fun season 4 was, and I was like, what times? I don't want to be super negative. Can we talk about something that makes me very happy? If we do.
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, I want to explain my, what was it, Tuesday night? I'm so jet lagged from my life right now. So I go to bed at 5 a.m. because I had a lot of work on. Wake up a couple hours later, check my phone, and see that Lockie is the Bachelor. And before I went to bed, it was talked about in the Patreon group, like, look at this Daily Mail article, Lockie has been leaked as the Bachelor. And I didn't believe it so hard that I truly believed they had photoshopped his face onto the body of someone holding a rose. I was like,
he did his own photo shoot with friends of, like, yeah, I'll get dressed up in a suit and hold a rose, and, like, everyone will think I'll be the Bachelor. Wouldn't that be like a fun little prank that I
play? That would have made more sense, but it was 4 a.m. for me, so I was like, that's photoshopped. Wake up, and he's the Bachelor. And I had, like, emailed PR the night before being like, what time's my exit interview tomorrow? Like, never expecting I wouldn't get one. And then I, like, woke up, I had this email, they're like, oh, well, there's no exit interview because Lockie's the Bachelor. And I was like, what? And then I went back to sleep, and then I, like, woke up, and I'm like, did I dream that Lockie was the Bachelor? But he was the Bachelor.
This is a reality. And Shannon, this is a sign we do not live in the darkest timeline, because as bleak as this week was, this is the most goddamn ridiculous piece of news that I have seen in quite some time. This is bananas. We are stealing bananas from Harry's hoard, and we are turning it into news. How did this happen?
I have so many questions.
So many. Well, first off, you weren't able to interview him, so this makes me believe that he is in some sort of hole somewhere, held by Channel 10. He is in a pit, Buffalo Bill style, where they are not allowed to talk to him before they release him into the wild to go seduce whatever innumerable amount of... Oh, he's absolutely in lockdown. But I'm thinking lockdown is like some sort of thing where like he's a hostage, where there's like a big bag over his head,
right,
and like he's not allowed to, like they're putting him, feeding him food under a door or something. They just want to get him nice and riled up and emotional before they release, you know, the various bachelorettes onto him. But how the hell did this happen? I only have, you know, American Bachelor to go off of, but we I don't think we at all actually ever had like a former reality star serve as the forefront of the Bachelor Bachelorette franchise. Like we've had like athletes, we've had, you know, prominent people in the world before, but we haven't outright said these are people, this is a person from another show, we're gonna gussy them up, send them on some group dates and see if they smoochy smooch their way down the aisle.
Well, let me give some Australian perspective. American Bachelor always has people who are on a, if not the former Bachelor or Bachelorette season, then like a former Bachelor or Bachelorette season.
Right.
Australia does it differently. Like we do have minor celebrities, like football players or like hosts or whatever. Channel 10 loves to kind of recycle their talent. I'm on 10 Play. I'm surprised I'm not the Bachelorette. Like the last Bachelorette was someone who was on Gogglebox, where they like watch TV, which is a Channel 10 and Foxtel show. Then she was on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which is Channel 10. Then she was a Bachelorette, and now she's on Dancing with the Stars. So that's how much is recycled in terms of the talent. I'm just surprised it's Lockie.
Oh my God, so incestuous.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think Lockie is helped out by the fact that Henry went early and David is married. I'm actually surprised David wouldn't do it anyway, and they wouldn't have him. But that I just, like,
the biggest move of all, I got a separation from my wife to go be the new Bachelor.
Yeah, and the casuals would love it, and they'd all be signing up. Like, Lockie, I said on Talking Trouble Week 1 when they did that skit, I'm like, he should be the Bachelor. Like, he definitely has the look. I think he's an entertaining, kind of emotional character, which is fun. It's definitely fun to have the crossover. I just, like, he wasn't even that big a character. Like, I feel like this is such a question mark move just in terms of, like, where his edit went. You would think that they would kind of maybe edit him more heroically, yeah, or give him a bigger edit.
Or play up the him and Brooke thing even more, which means I also think there's a non-zero chance that Brooke comes in and as an intruder on this season, you know, or he like consults with her of like, you know me best, Brooke, talk to me about these women.
Oh my God, I hope Brooke isn't an intruder. That would be like, that would be so demoralizing, like to have a guy that you're kind of flirting with or have like a bit of a showmance with, and then to have to then go onto a show with other randoms and win his heart. Like, definitely nothing is happening with Brooke, because if it was, wouldn't go on to be the Bachelor, and I think Brooke has a little bit more self-respect than to like go fight for him when
I don't know
she was here first.
And I've heard from certain former Vakama members that Lockie is only in it for the money, not for the love.
Well, who isn't? I mean, people go on. No, actually, can I just say, like, the Bachelor has a pretty good hit rate, and the Bachelorette in Australian Survive, I mean, in Australia, because it's not as extreme as America. They don't like get engaged. They just like go off and have like normal relationships and then like get engaged a couple years later. And there are like a lot of cute batchy babies in Australia. So we do it well. I've got a lot of hope for Lockie. I'm just confused that he wasn't, I guess, a bigger character, that they showed him calling Brooke his receptionist the night before announcing him as the Bachelor. There were some choices made, but I'm still living for it. It's just insane. Like, this is coming off that scene where AK was Osha and they pretended to be the Bachelor, and then they actually made him the Bachelor. And I think that he should be thanking his one-time rival AK. You cannot spell Lockie of the Bachelor without AK. So,
AK manifested this, you know? And if he had done like an impression of Ryan Seacrest, then Lockie would be on American Idol.
Well, I did really see somewhere that it was like, is all of the bits going to come true? Like, are they going to make like an actual talent show, the Makuta talent show? Is that going to be a TV show? Are we actually going to get Zach's exercise machine? Is there a genie making these things happen?
Is Lee going to don his daddy look to, you know, host the show? He can only do it when he has like a comb over and Nick's dirty cardigan on. I really hope that's the case.
Yeah.
But I also like this idea as well of like whatever reality show AK was hosting with Lockie, he had to be on, you know, like imagine if it was like Fear Factor of like, okay, you're going to have to eat bugs. And like now Lockie's like, damn it, I guess I'm going to have to apply to this now. I mean,
it sounds like a horror movie.
When did this happen? But like, when did they say, you know who would be good for this? The 7-foot-tall mountain man who's more tattoo than person. This is the guy that we want parading around, you know, the essence of finer living on The Bachelor.
Hey, that non-Photoshop photo that is apparently real, he scrubs up well. I get it. It's just, it's a fever dream. And I don't even know where to go with it. I think it's great news. It'll definitely get me. Like, I've fallen off a bit with The Bachelor, but I definitely try to have it on when I do. But I will watch it properly. I do think they should make Brooke the Bachelorette. I just, like, you know, I put it on Twitter, but a lot of news, like, a lot of conversation, this was a blindside. None of these things are blindside. This was a blindside. Like, I work for Channel 10. I'm like, I speak to some people from the season. No one has mentioned this to me. Which, like,
literally the host of the show was on the week before we're talking right now.
I saw Usher recently, spoke to him at length behind the scenes on Talking Tribal about both The Bachelor and Survivor, and not one person mentioned to me that he was going to be The Bachelor. Like, I love it. I'm so happy I was blindsided. I genuinely, like, I've just never been so shocked. And all right,
Can we look ahead to what this season's going to be? Because I know that, you know, in previous Bachelor franchises, you had people specifically apply to get with this person. So, A, what percentage of the cast do you think are going to be, like, genuine, I applied with the show to get with Lachlan Lockie Gilbert?
To be fair, I don't know if that's going to happen because I'm pretty sure he's in Lockie Down. Like, I think it's happening. Like, I don't know if they would have known.
So you think they're just going to surprise it? They're just going to unleash it, like, surprise, no, it's me, Lockie.
I genuinely think that's happening. I think it's starting, like, ASAP. Like,
okay, B, how early do you think they're going to do the group date where he, like, takes them camping, like, Outward Bound style? Because you know that's going to happen. He is not going to get with an indoorsy girl.
Well, he is, like, an outdoorsy person. I have some questions. Brooke said that she wasn't with him because it was too hard because he lives in Bali. So is the winner moving to Bali? Like, that's kind of like a big thing.
In addition to your engagement, you get a one-way trip to Bali as well.
Yeah, that's a lot. I don't know. Yeah, look, it's not just, like, the camping dates. I'm here for all the puns. And I want it to be worked in. Someone actually tweeted to me, was like, they should do it where they vote each other out. And, like, the last person standing has to be voted by the people who've been voted out to win Lockie's heart. I was like, oh, that sounds so fun. And then I was like, oh, wait, that's Survivor. That's why I like that thought, because I love Survivor.
You know, I guess in retrospect, when we saw in, like, what, the second challenge of season two, when Lockie's big willy was flopping around in Jesus the sand, God. Like, that, like, he'd probably be the Bachelor one day, you know? Or, like, it would translate into something that, like, it had a different way of showing itself in marketing. I guess, you know, if they were looking at Survivor, were there some other people that they could have used? Like, could you imagine Henry?
Yes. Henry would have been a great Bachelor. He's crazy. No, he's very good looking.
Henry would have like burned the set down. He would have been like, okay, here's a group date. You have to hide the other girl's insulin and see if she goes to the diabetic shock.
I think Henry would have been a really good choice. I would have liked to see, maybe we do a fire-making challenge between Henry and Lockie to decide The Bachelor. Maybe they did that behind the scenes. God. I don't know.
Henry's going to give the first impression rose to, like, a cameraman. Like, he'd be like, that's the biggest move of all. None of you are staying.
I do think, like, Lockie is not a boring character by any means. He's a very emotional alpha male.
Oh, no. When it gets down to, like, the final five or four, like, he is going to be, like, throwing fits.
Yeah.
And he's not even going to be, like, deprived of food this time. Like, he's just going to be so incredibly emotional that, like, he's going to make for good TV. I know people are saying, like, oh, I don't think Lockie's a good character. I disagree. I think we didn't see as much of the Lockie on season two on All Stars, but I think he has some qualities between his two appearances that will make for a good TV character, especially when emotions are involved. He really does seem like a guy who wears his heart on his sleeve.
I think Lockie's a great character. I like the choice to be the Bachelor. I just can't believe Usher didn't tell me. I just saw him. I'm just so confused by it, but I also love it. I feel betrayed by Usher.
Do you think that, like, any of Lockie's Survivor compadres are going to drop in as, like, friends, you know, to, like, consult with him?
Do you think they should switch out Usher with AK for an episode? I don't know. Like, is there that much, like, fanfare around Survivor? Like, we're losing in the ratings. Like, is this something where that's something they're gonna do? That's why it's such a baffling choice. Like,
if Lockie cleans the toilet with the toothbrush of a girl he gets rid of, will that help boost the ratings? Just combine all the reality TV tropes into one?
That is what Australia loves. Yeah, I mean, they probably should have got someone from Married at First Sight to be the Bachelor because they're crushing the ratings. But they probably figure, like, they'll just bring over all of the Survivor fans onto The Bachelor. And they were right, because I'm going to watch. So
This is just remarkable to me, because again, I'm trying to like make like a one-to-one comparison, and I guess, I don't know, would this be like, I mean, I guess we had like Jay from Millennials versus Gen X make his way onto X on the Beach, but X on the Beach feels like a level below, like those MTV shows feel like a level below The Bachelor, Bachelorette. I know The Bachelor, Bachelorette is problematic AF, but I feel like from like a prestige or like a popularity perspective, it's on an echelon of its own level. You know, it would be like, it'd be like if DK Chillin was The Bachelor, you know?
Why is he not?
Listen, I don't know. He'd be a very interesting bachelor, because you really have no idea what to get out of DK Chillin. Lockie at least seems a little predictable in that regard, and you know what you're going to get out of him. Though who knows? Maybe we'll see more. I don't know. We're going to meet Lockie's family. I don't know who sired this boy.
I got nothing. I said I wanted every exit interview from All Stars. I'm not going to get it. I would be upset about it, but honestly, I'm just going to frame the email where it was like, you can't have an exit interview because Lockie's the bachelor. He's doing bachelor things. Like, I can't even be mad at it because it's just crazy. And I feel like all of the negativity I had about this week is gone because it's just crazy. It's crazy. He's not going to be at the reunion, I guess. Like, there's so many things.
Oh, yeah,
maybe he brings someone to the reunion as a date, and that's one of the dates.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's going to be... Well, I know that like The Bachelor in the American version is like not afraid to just like spoil things due to contestants' social media, so maybe that will happen. Maybe Russell style, instead of replacing him with a fedora, they'll replace him with that horrendous mustache he had on for the first tribal council where Harry went home.
The giant mustache. You know what they should do? He should show up to the first episode when they get out of the limo with that mustache on. I actually have a JLP tweet about this. And then whoever doesn't leave has like passed the first challenge.
Do they do like the big crazy limo entrances on The Bachelor AU as well?
Nothing is as big as American Bachelor, because in case you Americans don't know, you guys are a little extra. So everything's just like not as extreme. They don't go like all around the world. They might have like one overseas trip or maybe two at like most. Otherwise, like they definitely have finales where they went from like Sydney to the Blue Mountains, which is like an hour and a half drive. They don't have fantasy suites. They don't do sleepover things. They don't get engaged. The one time they did, it went really poorly, so they don't do that anymore. It's very like, it's quite low key. It's pretty down to earth. Like,
I mean,
that's why
I don't know. I kind of prefer that to like the fanfare. I mean, I guess.
I mean,
actually,
it's
just sort
worse
of make
TV,
a,
but it is a better dating experiment.
Well, I guess to make a comparison, like American Bachelor has sort of become like the All Stars Dave confessionals, where like everything is so big and flashy that it almost becomes like a little formulaic, whereas you want those more authentic, more down-to-earth experiences overall.
Well, the American Bachelor at the moment is like the producers aren't even pretending anymore that they aren't like completely manipulating the situation. Like having Chase Rice be the singer for a date where the girl had dated Chase Rice is like just completely evil manipulation, which I love. I actually like, so I only enjoy watching The Bachelor with my mom, the American Bachelor especially, so we can snark about it. But because I moved away, I could only like watch it with her when I came back, and then we fell behind. So now I consume the product, but I watched like the first half of the season, and now my mom just like calls me three times an episode and updates me. But she doesn't have like the best memory, so it's like a very strange way to consume the product. But I also really
like
love
it. Game of telephone.
Yeah, she like calls me, she's like, you won't believe what happened, but she like doesn't remember the name, so she'd be like, you know that girl? I'm like, I don't know what's going on. I actually really enjoy it.
I'm getting things secondhand. I guess speaking of other reality shows and Dave, because I this is something that I did want to mention before I forgot, because again, maybe this is sort of like why your mileage may vary on Dave's depiction this season. But Dave really is like one of the best examples I can think of in recent memory of like someone who is a Survivor player who would is actually playing like a similar way that a Big Brother player would play, especially from like the U.S. version, because he's like playing things up in the diary room, he's making these crazy moves, but he's being underhanded behind everybody's backs. Like the way he was bringing up the energy specifically and like making all these antics happen, what I was reminded of is, and this is going to be, I apologize, completely lost on you, Shannon, but hopefully some people understand the reference, is when he was just willy-nilly flipping over all the decor in the cake reward. It was very much James Hewling from Big Brother 17 and 18. During the hide and go veto challenge, where he would just like tear the house apart. That's all I was thinking of. Like you said, talking about this last week, like he knows it's good TV the last time he did it, so he's just going to do it again to 11. Like I would be, especially because Big Brother AU is coming back and it's using the US format. If Dave wants to continue his reality TV career, I'd be very intrigued to see how he would do in that, because I actually think he'd be a pretty damn good Big Brother player and an entertaining character as well.
Well, Big Brother's on a different network, but definitely Channel 10 are reusing Dave somewhere. I can't believe they haven't put Dave and Luke yet on The Amazing Race. Like, that's something. Like, Dave has moved back to Australia now. He's going to be on Dancing with the Stars. Like, whatever it is. On the Channel
Wait,
10
what?
Network. I'm a, well, I mean, he's not. I'm just saying, I predict that will. I'm a celebrity I could see him on. Him and Luke, I could definitely see a lot of opportunities for both.
The issue is, though, he has no in-ground revenge with anyone on Dancing with the Stars,
that
right?
You know,
like,
what?
unless like someone trips him walking onto the stage, then he really is going to be able to like motivate himself. And I guess to
I'm going to outdance that person, so I have the most consecutive days on dancing.
Exactly. I have the most consecutive steps on this stage that's been danced by a person. I also want to make this comparison as well, because Elizabeth made it in the patron group. And again, for Big Brother players out there, I see the comparison as well. Shannon, I'm not sure if you know this guy. There's a young man by the name of Paul Abrahamian who has made quite an effect on American Big Brother. He played two consecutive seasons back to back, and he actually made it all the way both times. The first time out, he was this big underdog, fan favorite, goofy character who is also capable of winning competitions, making moves, makes to the end, loses the game, comes back the next season, brought in against all new players, and just completely runs the show. He basically corrals like a group of cults / pseudo bullies, instills very regimented control over the house, creating giant moves, some of the biggest the show's ever seen, that benefits him, and he loses in the end. And I don't see a complete one-to-one analog, but I do see the rough skeletons there. Granted, the beard's not there specifically, but I feel like the trajectory of Dave, especially in terms of popularity and control, is definitely there. I do feel the exception, though, is I do think Dave's going to win this game. I think he's going to clinch it. And Paul has had fundamental misunderstandings when it comes to jury management, almost like from a Moana perspective. And Dave is really seeming to handle, you know, every part of the game pretty well, especially interacting with people and making sure that the cocksure, braggadocious Dave of season 4 is not showing outwardly to those people, even if it is to the cameras.
I do think that the fan response to Dave is very intriguing. Like, there's a lot as well. I mean, this, I think I don't go on Facebook anymore, but the casuals are like loving it, but the super fans are kind of over it. Well, you know, not everyone, but there does seem to be a lot of that sentiment. And the crazy thing is that at this point last season, he had more confessionals than he does now. And it was like 40 more than Luke. Like, it was 40 more than the next people, like the Lukes and the Harrys, who had a lot of screen time. So what is the difference? Is it that he's been doing it against our favorites? Is it that it's that he's been hamming it up a little more and it seems a little less joyful, a little less genuine, the coach effect? Is it that the other big players in the game, the other big narrators, your Nicks, Henry to a degree, your Matts went out pre-merge, so you don't have the Harrys, the Luke, the Janines getting a lot of confessional in the merge, so he just feels like he's really rising up on top? Is it the fact that we didn't care that he was, you know, that Sam and Hannah, people cared, but you care much less that those faceless people are not getting confessionals so that Dave can get more confessionals where we really care, when it's people we've liked in other seasons, like a Flick, for example? So, you know, it probably is a little bit of all of those things. But if you think it's too much, we were all, so, I mean, again, all, everyone has different opinions, but the large sentiment was we were eating it up this time last season, and he had more confessionals, and he has about 8 to 10 fewer now, and everyone is like, it's way too much. Maybe is it the repetition? Mm. Is it the all-star thing? I still think he's entertaining, but the sentiment around him and the evolution of that is something I find fascinating.
So I have two prongs to it, and I agree that I think it really is a different criteria for every person. I think one is the positioning. Mario Lanza has always said that characters like Boston Rob and Stephanie are super entertaining to watch when they're an underdog and they're clawing their way out of the bottom. And he uses this word, insufferable, on top when they're in control and they still get the same amount of content, but instead it's them bragging about them being on top and just them maintaining this powerful majority. And they become less of I wouldn't say an interesting character, but at least someone they don't necessarily want to put your support behind. And we see that Dave has held a position of power, you know, for the vast majority, if not this entire game. And it's a very different story where, yes, he had more confessionals in season 4, but he was turning so many tricks in season 4. He was essentially an underdog for the a good part of season four. And so it makes sense that more of the content was going to him, right? Because he was turning all these crazy flips alongside a bunch of other people. Here it's more so that he's orchestrating these plans that he's already on the top of.
Yeah, he's punching down on Phoebe, Nick, Vakuma. And like, I think it's good strategy, but it's not as fun to watch.
Right. The other thing, and I think this is more of the thing for me personally, is just the repetition. Especially as of late, Australian Survivor has just become a very repetitive show in its storytelling. I was checking in the merge episode three different times over the course of the episode. Somebody recapped who is in what alliance, which is crazy to me. It seems like they really are like making the show, or at least telling the story, from a perspective of like, if somebody just tuned in now, they need to get caught up on what happened, which I feel like is a way that people don't really watch TV anymore. People
you're can wrong, definitely... though, Mike. Like, I'm telling you, I don't go on the Facebook page, which is probably worse. Go on Instagram. So many comments. Who got voted out tonight? Who got voted out? That's why they do it. That's why they've had the Godfather confessional from Benji a million times, because not everyone is like us, and not everyone is over 2 hours into this podcast and hasn't even got to the chili yet. We should really do that. But other people watch it on a Monday, but miss it on a Tuesday and get back on a Wednesday, and they have to be like screaming into their faces what is happening, and just like really making it very clear in a very simple way. Because I do believe that the casuals maybe aren't missing 42 minutes a week of a US Survivor, but are they watching all 4 hours? Many of them, yes, but not all of them.
But I, at the same time, I feel like that doesn't represent the majority of fans, or that I feel like, if that is the case, then I wouldn't say they're lost causes, but like, it feels like they're catering to a group of the fandom.
They're definitely
that
doing that.
Is not, yeah, it just doesn't feel, and maybe I don't want to be like super fans, you know, shaming casuals. It just doesn't feel very representative to have to cater to that.
And, well, they
you
think
know,
that the
again,
super fans are always going to watch, and they're right. And they think that if you're invested enough to watch every night, you're in it, which is probably true. And they want to hook the person who missed Tuesday. And if they don't understand by the end of Wednesday, they're not tuning in the next Monday. But if they kind of get it and they're back on track, then they're the 50-50 viewers that they're trying to like make sure come back next week.
It's really tough to watch, especially when you're sitting down for one helping and you hear Dave in episode 13 talk about quote unquote blindsiding Nick, and I'd say literally every scene at Makuta. And after a while, even though you love the guy and you love the chainsaw impressions that he does and all the weird pop culture references he makes that somehow don't go past the mid-aughts, at a certain point you're like, we get it. We understand what's going on. I think the Australian Survivor is capable of incredible storytelling. It showed that in its first two, arguably, you know, maybe its first three seasons. It can create Pixar level entertainment. Right now, they're doing Dora the Explorer, and they can do a hell of a lot better than Dora the Explorer. Dora the Explorer is going to pause to ask you questions. Other things will assume like we don't need to hold your hand. You will give you context, and we know you'll follow us along with this journey. And it's frustrating, again, from our perspective. To your point, I understand from a marketability why they would want to do it, but I do feel like it hampers our enjoyment sometimes. Now, that being said, I'm trying not to look at this in an entirely negative light. What I've been doing personally to make sure that this season is and the storytelling is not an exercise in frustration is, instead of looking at, you know, oh my God, they're shafting this, they're not mentioning this, I like to more so look at it as sort of an exercise of, okay, why are they making these choices? You know, what are they trying to tell us? And to be candid, I think the story of this season is how David Jeannette played the best game in Australian Survivor history. And I think that's why certain things have been neglected. I think that's a big reason why the whole mole thing was left on the cutting room floor, because I think that would show a vulnerability in his game. I think that's
one big
reason.
This would make him so much more interesting, but anyway.
Right, but they wanted to show how he played again, that one of the better games of all time. I think they wanted to show, you know, they really want to highlight him, not just because he's someone who provides a lot of energy and verve, but also because, I mean, people like David do not usually win Australian Survivor. And so I think that, you know, they really want to celebrate this, especially when we start hearing from the jury of like, we want big players to win. We want people who make big moves to win. He's been making the biggest moves of all. He's made some of the biggest moves in Australian Survivor history. And if he wins it, I firmly believe the show is celebrating it. I know that people are like, well, you know, there's the chance for some other people's people like Christy and Jericho and even Shane had less blatant edits. But I don't know. I feel like the Pia winner's edit was not an irregularity. I feel like it was the start of a trend. And I could very easily see, to the points that you were making before, how they really want to hammer home that David is the winner, and this is how he won in every single facet possible. Now, I think there's still going to be a lot of excitement to play out, because I think no matter what, David's going to provide for some good TV. He's going to make sure it's a rocky road along the way, even if he throws the rocks in his own path. I just think, you know, looking at it constructively as to why are they telling us these certain things? Why are they showing us these things over and over and over again? That's what I theorize is going to be the overall narrative of the season, even though, you know, we're only a little bit more than halfway through.
I do think the editors would think that robbing the season of all suspense to just make it the David show in a winning game would be good TV. I don't know if I agree with that. As much as I really, really like David as a player and a TV character, I feel like nothing should be that heavy-handed. So, I mean, I could see the editor's perspective thinking that. But yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for Australian Survivor and for US Survivor for all of these shows to talk down to their audience and kind of have to feel like they're holding their hands through it. And honestly, like, having looked at the Facebook page before I logged off, they might be right. So maybe they do need to explain it multiple times, and we're just, you know, we're watching it a different way, so it's frustrating to us. But we're talking so much about Dave. Can we finally get to the jizzy?
Yeah, I was going to say, let's keep the Dave talk rolling.
Yeah, okay, take it away, Jacob Sager-Weinstein and MC Color.
1, 2, 3. One,
it's getting kind of cheesy. 3, 2, 1. So Dave is going to get 3 points for me. The Nick vote, I still maintain, was a blind spot for him, not a blind side. But his power play at the merge is obviously amazing. He's running circles around everyone. It's been spoken about at length. You get it. 3 points. Zach, I'm going to give 2 points to for doing kind of a lot of that. I don't think he led it as much, and that's why I'm giving those points to Dave. But clearly he blindsided them, and Harry has said online what a great job he did in that. So, you know, and I like that he rescued birds, as I've said. So, and hard to give another point, but actually not that hard for me, because I'm going to give a memorial chizzy point to Nick. And it's not that sentimental. Like, I genuinely don't know if anyone else deserves it this week. Like, he wasn't blindsided, and I will cherish the confessional of him saying something's not right. I would cherish that he didn't let Dave walk all over him. He's one of the only people this season for that to be true of, and he wasn't blindsided, as much as people want to say it, as much as the casuals probably think he was, and I'm very, very proud of him, and I'm giving a point for all of that. The one I could have considered was Sean. I like that she voted for Nick and really has integrated herself into that majority when she could have been on the fringes and has now kind of like locked herself in, but I don't love that she was the one who had to give the name to AK and tell him that it was him, and kind of, you know, they kind of met at the merge. I don't know why they would have a working relationship, but that would be gone now. And to put yourself out there, I mean, obviously it's something that she's done a favor for her alliance, but she's played the middle so much. I don't know how much she should be putting herself out to kind of personally nigh people. So I kind of took her out of contention there. So what are your points, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, to the point where, I mean, she was being, and granted, Zach just sort of throw out her name as like a faulty thing, but the fact that she got 5 votes at the merge, you know, it's definitely something that, granted, she was not playing the middle here, but I think she is noticeable. And maybe that's also a reputation thing, where she was only 1 vote away from winning season 3. And yet somehow she and Lee have both made the merge, which I will say, overall, hats off to Lee and Sharn for doing that. Hats off to David and Harry, because Shannon, there were 5 season 4 people going to this season, and I would not believe at all if you had told me that the last 2 people remaining from season 4 were David and Harry, considering what everyone just saw them do. They have both been able to overwrite their reputations from what people just saw minutes before they went onto this season, and were able to, and you know, maybe it's a bit of a thing, I think this was talked about in the Winners at War podcast, about like, yeah, you can plan to get rid of Parvati based on what you see on screen, but like once you actually talk with her in person, you realize that, you know, an edit certainly colors a person a certain way. I could see that happen partially with David and Harry, so I just want to give some credit there. Of course, 3 points to David. Look, you can have gripes all you want to with the way he's being portrayed. I would say he probably does, but he probably doesn't. I'm sure he absolutely loves the attention, and he loves having the record for most consecutive confessionals in Australian Survivor. But the fact of the matter is, he has this game on lock right now. On locky. He's in a very comfortable position, insulated with idols. He was able to work the swing vote position very well, but to the point where, like, yes, he was hiding out in the next episode, but it really doesn't seem like, you know, he was earning disrespect. I think he's very beneficial as well in that people like Lockie and Harry are starting the jury, in that I think especially someone like Harry is really going to respect his game. And depending on, you know, how much they get into the ears of the other jurors, including the other Vakama people, that's going to have a huge amount of influence. It does not seem like those two are going to be especially bitter against somebody like David, despite the fact that he turned on them. I actually think even though he Captain Kirk style decried his immune system, I actually think him getting sick might have been the best thing to do after that merge vote, because all he needs to do is lay low right now, and he can give an excuse of like, no, I wasn't hiding out from you. I'm just sick. I'm contagious. I don't want to give anything away. So hopefully this doesn't mean that David was patient zero for coronavirus back in the fall, that he was the one who, talk about the biggest move of all, like causing a survivor pandemic. So obviously, 3 points to him. I'm going to give, you know what, as much as I really talk down Moana's winning chances at the moment, I'm going to give her 2 points right now, because I feel like what she was able to do, and I do give her credit for really being the rallying force of Makuta, because she really is in control of that triad of her, Tarzan, and Jackie, and wherever she goes, they go. And I fundamentally think if she didn't want to work with Sharn, Lee, and David, then they wouldn't work with them either. I think, you know, she was able to establish a good core, was able to utilize David and Zach well as resources, and, you know, guarantee themselves a majority. And she has a pretty damn clear path right now. Granted, that's going to change. Is it a winning path? That's debatable, but I have to acknowledge the situation that she's put. Plus, I loved her rebuttal again to Lockie's stupid big moves argument. That,
Mike, you know, it was tribal council.
It's still a stupid argument, though. I don't want people to take it the wrong way and to have them be like, well, Lockie said that people respect big moves, so that's the only way you can play Survivor. No. Look at 4 previous seasons of Australian Survivor. That is not the way you need to play a 50-day game.
Well, that's who Lockie's going to be giving his roses to, the people who make moves.
Yeah.
So now you know.
Oh, exactly. It's going to be big dance challenges every single day to see who makes the biggest moves. And I'm going to give 1 point to Zach. I cannot believe I am giving Shizzy points to Zach in my life. But you brought up, you know, you said it well, that I think that he actually did play the middle well, even if it was a bit understated. It really doesn't seem like people are mad at him, even though he didn't flip over to the Vakamas. Like, he could very easily say later on, like, listen, this is all about timing. It wasn't my time. And so, you know, if he does make it to the end, I don't think people would begrudge him that much for not making a move with the Vakamas, considering that he was definitely considering it. He wasn't outright denying it, but he was doing it for the betterment of his own game. So it's crazy, but I'm going to have to throw him a point here. And, you know, I'll give some honorable mentions to, like you said, the Nicks and Harrys of the world, who both really tried to work up against a giant wall, and they tried to scale it a little bit, but ultimately it was the greasiest wall you can imagine. They just slid right back down to the bottom.
Okay, well, this week my husband came to me and he was like, Shan, the Chizzy has lost all meaning. Where are the Chizzy charts? So I just want to say how much I love my husband, that this is something he cares about, but also, like, he was right. Where are the Chizzy charts? My brother will be working on them, on the cruise. We're not, you know, we need the Chizzy charts, Jay. But I did go through and I calculated the points so we can actually give a bit of a 5-week rundown of where everyone is at. So Dave is winning. With our 6 points, he now has 16 points. I was calculating in my head. I almost got it wrong. So that's 16 for Dave. Matt is still coming second with 11. And then
this seems like the confessional charts again.
It is. Well, I mean, AK has gotten, I think, more Chizzy points than confessionals. He's been pretty consistent, but he could have more in terms of confessionals. But he's next with 6. And then you've got Sean and Harry were both on 5. Shawnee is on 4. Abby, Nick, Mo, and Zach are now all on 3. And I think those are the only people with points. So we will see where it goes. But yeah, I'm glad that we finally got it out there.
I mean, we experienced this a bit, you know, with Survivor South Africa, Island of Secrets, with, like, you know, again, it really depends on if we're going to watch one player run away with the game. But I'm
one
hopeful,
dominant
you know,
some... player surrounded by an insanely unlikable group, take like being mean or winning over people I really like in the show and real life. Oh my god, it's exactly
Deja.
The same show.
Oh boy, it's like a deja vu all over again. Well, to that point, I mean, I will say one thing that I did enjoy in retrospect of Island of Secrets is I do feel like we at least got some perspective there as to the other members of the Alliance. You know, it wasn't always about what Rob thinks. We did find out a good amount of like how Nicole feels about things, how Steffi feels about things, and that sort of informed their psychology and decisions, no matter how warped they may be. And I hope they do that here. You know, as much as we might say that people like Tarzan and Jackie do not make for as good confessionalists as someone like David, it'd be nice to get their perspectives. You know, I'd like to see if it was a final three of the two of them and Moana, who's going with who. You know, what are sort of the dynamics? What are their thoughts about it? Because that fleshes out this cast a bit more. I know that AU tends to edit more of main characters, supporting characters, and cameos, and not the reality stars that are going to talk to you for like $20 and, you know, sing happy birthday to you or something. But it'd be nice to at least get to know if this rock solid alliance is going to hold. I would personally like to know a bit more about these Australian amigos.
Well, I mean, I have to say, like, in terms of the amigos and Saula in general, as much as they might have been unlikable sometimes, they were always fascinating. Nicole, Steffi, Sipe is not unlikable, but, you know, some of the most fascinating characters we've seen. And maybe the problem with, you know, Dave's group isn't like likability as well. Maybe it is that, but also a little bit of like just not having that great character development and interest as much as Saula. And I genuinely never thought that I would be singing the praises of Steffi, but like, give me Steffi over Jackie. At least she was interesting.
Read you loud and clear, Shannon. Australian Survivor needs to row. Let's call up the producers.
Australian Survivor needs a few of these South African Survivor players. I would take them. I would take them at this point, having railed on the cast.
Oh my god. Imagine a Durouchler, just how that would go.
I was going to say, like, why isn't Rob Bentley the Bachelor? Like, in all honesty, he should actually be the South African Bachelor.
Those eyes, he'd hypnotize them all.
It's crazy that he's not. I'm pretty sure it's on the same network. Like, he should be the Bachelor, but I would definitely take Durow. There's a lot of good there.
I give you this rose, but I lost it in the ocean when I went swimming.
Also, how fitting they were mentioning Durow on the episode where they brought up bananas. Perfect.
Maybe Durow had a secret stash. Oh, no, he wouldn't film in Fiji. Otherwise, imagine they like stole from his $1 million stash that he was going to spend the money on to invest in. Like, Durow's legacy steeps everywhere. He's doing a viewing party at Hearts of Reality with Janet Carbon.
I know. That's the most incredible. Besides the lucky information, that is just ridiculous news.
I never thought I'd hear a more incongruous pair than the two of them. To be a fly on the wall and just to listen to the conversation that goes on between the two of them. Like, oh, I need to hear everything about it. Patrons who are going there, give me the full kitty. Give me the full
Skypuss with Durow. Bring him his bananas.
Yeah, exactly. I need everyone to bring Durow a banana so we can get up to 1 million. We can crowdsource his bananas.
And now a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
And we are back. All right, let's go from one thing that gives me joy, Durow, into JLP tweets. So he said, the requisite dirty tweet of the week, difficult to get a grip on your pole when it's wet and slippery.
That pole challenge, it felt like to me like the Australian Survivor equivalent of the we're going to tie your hands and feet together challenge, because it just feels like a challenge to like humiliate the contestants of like, we're going to watch you shimmy up this greasy pole when you're only in your underwear, but it's not going to be sexy to anyone ever except for Lockie, apparently.
And the like, JLP called it tragic and he had his Wolverine laugh. painful, painful stuff to watch, and I'm sure to do. Also, in terms of challenges, this is important. JLP tweeted, he said, they extended the edit of the immunity challenge, but Shawnee did it in 3.5 minutes. Amazing stuff.
Holy
it ain't easy.
Moly.
When we were testing, it took me 30 minutes. Firstly, my brother's rant about this. He's like, the challenges are so long. Why would they extend it? Like, why do they do that to us? But also, I have to rant a little bit again about Lee's advantage.
He stood up, this is not an advantage.
Over 2 hours to get one extra block. You can say what you want, 9 blocks is harder. I definitely think that the pain on your body in over 2 hours is not worth even remotely that advantage. The look on Lee's face was so funny when he said it. And he even said later back in camp, he said, this is a bit of a stitch up. Do you have stitch up in America?
No, unless you're talking about some sort of medical term.
No, a stitch up is like, this is a joke, basically. Like, he's been pranked. And it was a total stitch up.
Like, do you mean like it'll leave you in stitches, or like this prank's so good it'll cut you open and we'll have to stitch you up afterwards?
It's neither of those things. It's just like a stitch up. People Google it. Sometimes I don't know I'm saying things that are like local. I said Mo landed with her bum in the butter for the swap, and now I guess the merge, which was apparently like a South African term that was Dutch and then Afrikaans and then South African, and my parents use it all the time, but no one knew what I was talking about. So clarifying some things that I say. But yeah, I mean, super unfair for Lee. I put a poll on Twitter asking what is the worst reward. DIY fish and chips, the box of crap that they got last time, the grazing table with an extra vote, which is a terrible advantage, only for one person that sows paranoia coming into a new tribe, or this, and this actually won. So that is a very low bar.
Recency bias. Can I write in the bag of melted chocolate from Survivor New Zealand?
You can't. The Survivor New Zealand is like a shame. They have no budget. Like, you should only be comparing between Australian Survivor.
But yeah, I would say, actually, I know Jeff Pittman was comparing this, like, is this up there with the Malcolm Wendell, you get to restart the balancing the ball challenge? I think this one's worse because this one just seems fundamentally like if you're not skilled in it, you can't do it. I feel like the balancing the ball challenge is a bit more of an even playing field, but it really does show. And maybe Lee should have done more fake Pilates to help his case. But also the face he gave JLP was just like such incredible, like the F face of like, oh, that's not an advantage whatsoever. I had to put my ass on the line holding a damn clay pot for 2 hours just so I could lose an immunity challenge. Great. Thanks. Glad I had that merge feast.
It's also just so funny because the challenges to win these terrible rewards are always so hard. Like, it's not just, it's honestly like the pain to his body for standing there for over 2 hours definitely was like way more of a disadvantage in the challenge. So,
right.
Just hilarious.
Can I also say this is not a JLP thing. I know it's a production thing, but I just want to gripe on, like, I wish that JLP would stop. I would also say, now that the merge has passed, he won't be doing this anymore. I wish that in the mat chat, JLP wouldn't ask the other, like, the tribe details about the tribal council.
Just responded to something about this on Instagram. I think I saw that. That he doesn't want to. Like, classic JLP, yeah, just, like, being said, like, nah.
Which I would say, like, Survivor AU, like, look, you don't need to make the host the EP. We know that, like, that can be a sticky situation, but, like, at least listen to him. Because I agree, like, it's not him in season one being like, hey, Brooke, just to catch you up, Phoebe played her idol last round, and oh, man, is she a good player? No need to kidnap her. No, not whatsoever. But it is still a little weird to be like, David, that was a crazy tribal council. Care to elaborate to the other tribe? Like, it's a weird way to get information out there. Let the players volunteer it, you know?
Well, I mean, JLP is not the one. Look, we've had a lot of gripes for the Australian Survivors. We put that at the bottom of all of the issues we've had in this podcast. We really like that Lockie of the Bachelor. JLP also said, oh, shit. Only 5 minutes in and David said it twice. I'm an all-star and I'm playing an all-star game. That's a double shot right there. But then the next night he tweeted, ah, shit, it was me this time. This is all-stars, baby. We've turned it up to 11. I'll do 3 shots for that. So that was a bit of a connected tweet.
Oh, I love that. I love JLP acknowledging the memes as well between like the Sean 10 stuff from the preseason. Like, he actually seems pretty well attuned to the community, which is just so much fun. I think the fact that he doesn't have like, not necessarily a stake in the show, but like doesn't have like a hand in the production of the show, means it can be a bit more loose and fancy free. And that makes it a lot of fun to enjoy as a viewer as well.
Yeah. I also alluded to this one last one. He did say, nice porn stash, Lockie. Should have kept it for your next gig. So.
Oh, boy. Ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he didn't mean that The Bachelor was going to be his gig. Maybe he meant like a different type of gig in which a porn stash would necessitate.
I think that if a woman can look past that and still wants to love you, like, that's going to be a lasting relationship. So I see the strategy.
How is he going to kiss a woman? He is extraordinarily tall. How are they going to get both of them
tall
in frame?
Tall people are people, too. Like, he can still
But are they going to have to do something like how they filmed The Lord of the Rings, where, like, he has to walk around on his knees the entire time, or they're going to have to film him from a perspective angle? Because I can imagine a situation where he is, like, twice as tall as some of the women on the show.
Mike, have you not watched The Bachelor? What they do is they jump into his arms and wrap their legs around him. I've never seen anyone do that except in The Bachelor, and I guess Nicholas Sparks movies.
But knowing Lockie, he'd probably bench them afterwards.
Yeah, and that's why he's the perfect bachelor. He's kind of just, like, this large tree that they can, like, wrap around like a koala. And that's probably a lot of the requirements. So, good casting. We've answered a lot of questions, which, yeah, you might have understood because it's been a very long podcast. I've got a couple that I'm still going to ask. Barbecue Ice asked on Twitter, do you think Sean is trying to use Monica's strategy of saying yes to every plan and then doing what you want? And I love this question because when he asked it, I had a flash of Monica doing that to Sean. And now I feel like Sean is doing that to others.
I guess the question is, like, I mean, did Sean ever say no to anybody in season 3?
Well, I just don't think she was in that position as much, where she was, like, obviously she was obviously a champion. And then I guess if you're in that position, you should always say yes. The reason I was higher on Monica's game than what some of Sean is doing is that I feel like Sean has been more alone in the swing, and you should never be in the swing position alone. She does have Lee, and I think that's crucial. Like, if she's ever going to be flipping and flopping, flip with Lee, because that needs to be your Mateo, your Wu, what Brian and Monica did together, which was important. But I think that Sean has been, like, she was way more with the Rascals than with what Lee was. She was the one who voted, like, differently at that Thai tribal council. She's been more all over the place than even Lee has, and it's been quite alone. So I do think that what will be key to her game is making sure, whether it's a Lee or maybe a Moana, if that becomes a tighter connection, whatever they're doing, do it together. Because if you're just in the middle by yourself, that's never good, because people may be mad at the end and then you don't have that natural person to sit next to. And also, like, it just makes it more obvious and gives you less protection.
Right. I'm so intrigued. And maybe this will come from a Sharn deep dive after the season as to, like, was this an active change in her gameplay, or did this just come through circumstance? Because, I mean, a lot of Sharn's greatness just came from her completely being on the back foot, starting with the Matt vote, of, like, all the stuff she was able to pull out between the idol plays and tricking Brian into, like, not splitting the vote the right way and just being able to make all these moves happen to save her. But here she wasn't necessarily in that situation, and it seemed like she was playing differently. But I wonder if it was just because of, like, the way Makuta shook out, or if she purposely went in sort of Lee style, saying, I need to do this, this, and this because I didn't do that last time.
It's hard to assess your game when you lose by one vote, but I think that it was a detriment to her game to be confusing. Like, maybe she's not doing as much of the mateship stuff, and she feels like that will be, or the loyalty stuff, and she feels like that will be helpful. And I agree that it would be. But I think that people kind of didn't know where she stood, or what, yeah, couldn't, like, get an understanding of her game, because she would say one thing, do another, say loyalty, like, say, you know, do another. And as much as some people think that her loss was unfair, I think that the jury just didn't get a clear perception of, like, what she was trying to do. She certainly didn't articulate it at Final Tribal Council. And I just hope she's not falling into that similar path just by not really taking a stand. And, like, maybe, like, people who sit on the jury will look like Nick did and be like, she was very slippery. So that could come back to bite her. But I don't know if it really is. But at least I haven't heard loyalty or mateship or anything from her. So maybe that's enough to get one extra vote, you know, to win the game.
No, that's super interesting, though. Sharn is the Aaron Burr of this season, right? She'll stand for nothing. What will she fall for?
That's so true, Mike. Ugh, thank you for bringing the Hamilton reference into it. Oh, I loved it. You're so right. You're so, so right.
She's Sharn. Aaron Sharn.
She's Aaron Sharn. I do feel like she's smiling less. She's smiling more. She should probably talk less and not be going to AK and being the one to give him the name. But I do think that you're right. I feel like that with Sharn. She hasn't taken a stand. We'll see where we land. Like, come on, Sharn.
Yeah. And she's going to wait for it, right? Like, she doesn't want to make a move and feel like she missed out on an opportunity. She's lying patiently.
Yeah, and David is Hamilton. You know, he exhibits no restraint. He takes and he takes and he takes confessionals. He keeps winning anyway. God. He changes the game, plays and he raises the stakes. Oh my God.
Wait a minute. We just made a mind-blowing discovery about this season 2.5 hours into a podcast.
But if there's a reason that he seems to thrive and so few survive, then goddammit, she's going to wait for it.
Holy crap. And David is somebody who, like, talks a lot, and people start to, like, they respect him, but they don't really like him sometimes just because of the way he sort of composes himself, but he has good ideas. Like, this is just playing out in my head right now. But we know who shoots who at the end. And so the question is, will history repeat itself? Or, I mean, history has its eyes on Australian Survivor.
David is Hamilton confirmed. I'm loving this discovery. I feel like we've maybe lost some people, but I love it. It's not the first time that we've actually played out Hamilton in a Survivor season.
That's true, actually.
We've podcasted a lot together, so it's fine.
It only comes that, like, apparently this is like a topic we'll come back to no matter what, the franchise.
These are the only two things in my life, Mike. Hamilton and Survivor, so it makes sense. This is a Venn diagram of who I am as a human being, and I brought up football. Now you know me. That's it. Last question from someone who I think is loving this conversation right now. My brother, Jason Gates, brother/intern, asks, where does this pre-merge rank among the other Survivor AU seasons?
Ooh, okay, that's a tough one. I'm going to put... So 2 for me is number 1. Oddly enough. Yeah, I just think... Because I think that there was just, like, you could say 4. I think 4 was a damn good pre-merge as well. But I think something against it is just, again, like, the purpling of basically the entirety of pre-merge contestants made us care less about the boots. Like, they were awesome stories, but they didn't necessarily bring the weight to the boots. I mean, season 1 is definitely up there. There's a reason why people were hooked from Australian Survivor from the get-go. And say what you want to about the post-merge, but the pre-merge, as much as the decimation of Vivao was its own level of depressing, I thought it was really fascinating television. Season 3 is definitely down there. I think, see, the thing is...
I agree. We bookended it. 2 is first, 3rd is last. 100%, right?
Right. I think I'd put All Stars above 3 at this point. So I think for me, it probably goes 2, 1, 4, 5, 3. In that, I think that, you know, I think 5 has some great stuff to it. Again, the Daisy episode is just awesome. Awesome television. But I think just between the way that certain things were portrayed, I think the boot order, which in retrospect sucks to get rid of all those stars before the merge, especially in lieu of some other people who have survived, you know, in their stead. I think that, you know, that's going to be below the other ones, but it's above the slog that was that season 3, especially, you know, for that stretch when the contenders kept losing. So it's going to stay out of the very bottom.
Yeah. Did you say 2-4-1 or 2-1-4?
2-1-4.
For me, 2-4-1-5-3. So pretty similar.
Okay, pretty similar.
That's it. That's all we got. We're like literally so long into this. Talked about Lockie, complained a bunch, got to the point where things were making sense to us about these people being Hamilton characters, but I'm pretty sure we just might be too far in at this point. But that's fine. What is the hashtag? Aaron Schoen is a late contender. Titanic with a K, I love. Lockie down. What are we doing?
I personally really love Aaron Schoen.
I've really missed podcasting with you. Like, we haven't done a recap since we did.
I know, we broke
our Survivor South Africa content.
Of most consecutive Survivor South Africa podcasts.
I should have voted you out so I could have had the most consecutive Survivor South Africa podcast.
Darn it, you missed that. Yeah, I think it's gotta be Aaron Schoen, just because we went so many different places. I apologize to people out there. I hope we weren't being too much Debbie Downers, but I think this is a frustrating part of the Survivor season. That being said, I'm looking on brighter days. I think there's interesting ways that these things can go, even if it is a Dave Marsh to the end. I think he's playing a very compelling, interesting game, and I think it'd be very fascinating to watch. And no matter what, you know, I think there's something to always talk about in Survivor, whether that's an editing choice, whether that's a player choice, whether it's a funny thing that happened in the cold open. It's something that I love about the show, no matter how many times the seasons may make us shed tears of sadness. So I'm very thankful for the opportunity, Shan, to come on and to hear you absolutely become a star talking about Australian Survivor in your own right, even when it's not the brightest, and to also launch our Survivor contestant consulting career as well.
Yeah, I mean, you won't make merge, but Mike and Shannon Strategic Consulting, you won't make the merge.
We'll get you, you'll get a, you'll 4 chizzy points guaranteed.
You got 3 chizzy points.
Oh no. All right. Well,
it wasn't his fault, and it wasn't our fault, and it was the swap's fault, and it was the producer's fault, and it was Dave's fault. I'm just writing Wandorf's in my head, like, pardon Lee, are you Aaron Schoen? So anyway.
Oh.
It's so niche. So many people are being turned off by this. Please don't turn off the podcast. I have some plugs. Mike, firstly, what do you have going on?
So I am, as you said in the very beginning of this monolith of a podcast, writing and podcasting a slew about Survivor Winners at War. I'm, of course, podcasting with the great Liana Boris on the RHAP BNB. It's essentially, I would say it's the opposite of this podcast in terms of just pure nonsense, but really it's more akin to like the last 10 minutes of this podcast. Like, this is a good sample of what the BNB is. It's pure fun and games. We talk about literally anything under the sun that might have to do with Survivor. It has been so incredibly fun so far. So be sure to put it into your Survivor podcast rotation if that interests you. Over on parade.com, due to the edge of extinction, there is no exit press. Everyone's in lockdown, as it were. But what I'm doing is a special series where I'm going to be talking every week to a person who played with the winner of that season. So, for example, you know, this past week, unfortunately, Ethan Zahn went. So I talked to Teresa T-Bird Cooper, who played with Ethan in Africa, about her thoughts on him. So it's not exactly a direct exit interview, more like an exit interview of an exit interview. But I thought it's a great way to celebrate Survivor after 20 years. Australian Survivor, I'm writing a weekly column called Bloomerang. Yes. Thanks for the name, Shannon.
It was Nick, though. On... And I guess you paid him with the puzzle.
I guess it's his recompense, yeah, for the advising, is that he got to name my column later on.
Yeah, I mean, just a really short origin story. The first podcast I ever did for Australian Survivor with Nick in season 2, I said I wanted to be Joss Wiggler because he was... you know, Rob Sestaninos, and then you said you would be yourself because you do both coverage, and then he said you would be Mike Bloomerang, and I remembered that, and I was like, you should use that for your column, and you did, and so just amazing origin story.
Yeah, the reference ended up coming back, ironically enough, so I'm doing weekly coverage. I'm sure I'll repeat a bunch of opinions that I said on this podcast, but if you want to check it out in written form, be sure to do so. That's been a lot of fun to write. And I'm also covering scripted television because I'm not crazy enough. Josh Wiggler and I are going down the hatch doing some other island-related coverage, talking about Lost. For believe it or not, Shannon, some of our podcasts are even longer than the ones we're doing now on a weekly basis about Lost, which has been an incredible amount of fun. And I'm going out of this world with Jessica Lise every week on Star Trek Picard. I plug all this stuff and much more reality TV musings over on my Twitter at a Mike Bloom type. So be sure to check all that out.
Mike, I've been feeling like you this season with how many plugs I have. Usually I just kind of have like, you know, the one thing I'm doing, but I feel like I have a lot. It's not quite up to your standard, but
you're a patch panel at this point. Like, there's no plugs. There's plugs plugged into you, and then you plug into the wall. There's just not enough like outlets for the plugs you're doing right now.
Yes. Yeah, so what do we have? Firstly, follow Mike at Mike Bloom Type. Follow me at Shannon Gates. Subscribe to the International Survivor Wrap Ups feed. Last week I was like, we've been second, we've been third on the charts. I'd love to be number one, and we were number one. Thank you so much to everyone for listening. That made me very happy and very excited to kind of see it validated in that way. We beat the podcast about Married at First Sight, even with the toilet toothbrush. So career goals there, everyone. No global this week. I did do one with Mike Fenter for week 3, so check that out if you haven't. Next week is something special that I'm pretty sure Rob just announced on Know It Alls while we're doing this. So I'll announce it because this will be released after. Rob is doing a live show with Steven, so people have wanted some studio content live after the episode, so actually I'll be hosting Know It Alls.
Yeah,
With Rick Devin.
You've officially done it, Shannon. You've taken over the empire.
And I'm never giving it back.
The key is now yours.
Yeah, if he thinks that I'm giving it back because he's coming back to the studio next week, like, he's gonna have to kick me out because I'm doing it now.
Oh, I'm so late. Your rise to the nose. I mean, you did an incredible job covering everything last season in that very tough position. Now that it's much easier content to talk about, maybe more emotional on a different level, I'm so, so excited to hear you break everything down with Rick next week. It's going to be an awesome time.
Yeah, and you know, it's Winners at War, so there's going to be like half an hour of me just like being so excited and then maybe some strategic analysis.
And thank you for getting in the requisite This Is Winners at War reference as well.
Hey, I know what works. I know what the producers want with the repeated confessionals. My exit interview with Nick is already out. I released that separately because I just wanted to kind of pay respect to what Nick means to the community. I also just loved it and was like, I'm just releasing it right now. It was my favorite exit interview I've ever done. It was the strangest full circle moment ever. The fact that I'm only on this podcast because of Nick and what he has done for me and his mentorship of me, and that I'm conducting his exit interview. If you told me that in 2017 when we were doing season two together and making up games, just insane stuff. So check that out. Harry, I should be interviewing in about an hour, unless he becomes the Bachelor in that time. So I think I got him. Lockie, as we said, is busy being the Bachelor. So unfortunately, we did miss that one.
That's
out.
A ridiculous sentence.
I know. I'm so scared. What if all of my exit interviews? I'm so glad you didn't become the Bachelor, Mike, and that you were here today. Otherwise, it would have been left on the lurch.
There would have been a lot of complications if that had actually happened.
Hey, Sean, I can't do the podcast today because I've become the Bachelor.
Yeah, my life has fallen apart because now that I've become the Bachelor. So, I mean, a podcast is the least of my problems, but I'll have to, unfortunately, abdicate my chizzy points this week.
That's something that happened to me yesterday. I lost a podcast guest because they became the Bachelor. It's crazy. Next week, unless she becomes the Bachelorette, but she is married, my guest will be Tessa O'Halloran.
I love me some Tessa. I'm so excited to hear from her, especially about this season, considering she'll certainly have, hopefully there'll still be season two people left by the time that it comes around. I'm sure, you know, again, as much as we may gripe about, maybe Tarzan, what he's bringing to the table, I'm sure she's going to have a lot of thoughts about Tarzan and AK in particular, and as well of Lockie being the Bachelor.
It's insane. I've got a complex now. I don't want Tessa to become the Bachelorette in the next week, but if not, you will see her here. But Mike, we've reached peak ridiculousness. Hashtag Aaron Schoen. That's with a U in Schoen. I'm so sorry, everyone. I hope you got through this. Thank you if you did. Thank you to everyone for listening.
Thank you,
Mike. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for missing Winners at War. And at this point, maybe next week's Winners at War. I've missed the cruise.
Yeah. I'm just going to camp out for the next week or so. I think I'm good until next week. I might have to take Tessa's place if she's too busy being whisked off with Osher or something.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a pleasure as always. You know, I love chatting to you about anything, you know, that no one else indulges me in this insanity. And like that's wrong. Like I need
likewise.
This in my life.
Likewise. And we have to fill the time until Survivor South Africa comes back, and it is coming back, and so will our coverage at some point, but for now we're filling our days talking about other random Survivor musings.
Genuinely filling our whole days. It's been a long podcast. Thank you again to everyone for listening. Mike, thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes, and I will see you next time, assuming I don't become the Bachelorette. Bye.
Australian Survivor
is saying Survivor New Zealand.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
£1 million.
Million.
The adventure of a life.